In a landmark class action lawsuit settlement, the Los Angeles City Council agreed to pay nearly $13 million to those injured or mistreated in the 2007 May Day demonstration in MacArthur Park. As the march ended, LAPD riot police were filmed by camera crews using excessive force, firing rubber bullets, and striking people wantonly with batons.
The new foreign minister for Israel is going to be Avigdor Lieberman. It is basically a fascist party. Lieberman is called, among other things, for the forcible removal of all Palestinians from Greater Israel, force of loyalty oaths for all Israeli citizens of Palestinian descent. It's a bad, bad sign for where Israel is headed.
This week in radical history for the week starting March 30th. Since we're having studio recording problems at Gleegly Studios this week, this week's show is an abbreviated version of what you've come to know and love. And since April 1st is International Pirate Radio Day, we are bringing you an awesome sampling of pirate radio blasts from the past. That'll be at the end of this week's show. Here we go.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey,
on this day, March 30th, in 1855, on the eve of statewide elections in the U.S. state of Kansas to determine whether or not Kansas would allow slavery, some 5,000 pro-slavery thugs from neighboring Missouri crossed the border to intimidate anti-slavery Kansans and to commit electoral fraud. They were successful for a time in that, with more votes cast than registered voters, a pro-slavery legislature was seated. This was the crucible in which famed abolitionist John Brown earned his reputation as an uncompromising fighter as well as an incorrigible individualist. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
Lithuania. Anarchist writer, activist, and feminist Emma Goldman lives.
This week in radical history for March 31st,
1986, following a 12-year campaign, a New York City gay rights ordinance is signed, 1990. England. Trafalgar Square poll tax riot. The riot brought into focus the growth in Britain of an underclass seen in collision with symbols of late 1980s wealth. These crystallized political disenchantment.
Tens of thousands of people demonstrated against the poll tax in central London, rallying in Trafalgar Square.
The head of the march was still pouring into the square as the first trouble started in Downing Street. The officer in charge of the operation believes the hardcore wanted to storm Downing Street.
Violence was caused by around 3,000 among them.
At this stage, the square had been turned into a virtual battleground. But running street battles are continuing and have spread to the area around Leicester Square, where cars are being overturned and shop windows are being smashed.
And these riots would topple the Thatcher government. And in 2002, former UN weapons inspector and former US Marine, Scott Ritter, has warned that America will lose the Iraq War, and the American military, quote, "We will leave Iraq with its tail between its legs," unquote. This week in radical history for April 1st. It is International Pirate Radio Day. More on that later in the show. 1649 diggers occupy St. George's Hill, near Cobham, Surrey, seizing land to hold in common and to plant. Other communities follow.
Our freedom for to win. Stand up now, diggers all. Against lawyers and against priests, stand up now, against lawyers and against priests, stand up now. For tyrants they are both, even flat against their oath, to grant us they are loath, free meat and drink and cloth, stand up now, diggers all.
The diggers tried to reform by leveling real property and the existing social order with an agrarian lifestyle based on their ideas for the creation of small, egalitarian, rural communities.
That
They were one of a number of nonconformists, dissenting groups that emerged around this time.
Stand up now.
1918, during this month the final issue of Emma Goldman's Mother Earth Bulletin is produced. Future publication is made impossible by ongoing government seizures. 1938 in Spain. The Lincoln Brigade is overrun by the fascist armies near Gandesa. The battalion suffers heavy casualties. The Lincoln Brigade was comprised of US and other internationals fighting the fascists during the Spanish Civil War. Perhaps most noted fighter was George Orwell. He would write Homage to Catalonia about his war experiences as the democracy-loving US rushes to recognize the fascist dictatorship.
This Week in Radical History for April 2nd,
1908 in Rome, during a funeral for a worker who died in an industrial accident, confrontations occur with the police, who oppose the procession. Police open fire, killing 4 and wounding 17. Among the dead is the anarchist militant Paolo Chiarelli. A general strike is declared, and subsequently, several anarchists are arrested, tried and condemned to heavy prison sentences. 1969, 21 Black Panther Party members are charged with conspiring to kill cops, bomb New York City stores, and trying to blow up police stations. 13 are prosecuted in September. After an 8-month trial, the jury took only 2.5 hours to vote to acquit.
This is your Radio Root supporter, Hannah George. On this day, April 4th, in 1859, a popular blackface minstrel show in New York called Bryant's Minstrels debuted the song I Wish I Was in Dixieland, which promoted the idea that enslaved black people were happy, content, and actually longed to be on plantations. The song became an instant hit, especially in the South, where it gave voice to the pre-Civil War sentiments of Southern whites. Just 2 years later, the Dixie Song became the battle hymn of the Southern Confederacy as they marched into Civil War to defend the institution of slavery. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
1900, Prince of Wales escapes anarchist assassination attempt. 16-year-old Jean-Baptiste Cipido takes 2 shots at the prince in the Brussels railway station in protest against the Boer War, apprehended, but acquitted July 5th.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, April 5th in 1621, the Mayflower left the Plymouth colony where it had landed 1 year earlier in order to return to England. The English had begun the colonization of North America in the 1580s by building small colonies along the Atlantic coast, including the successful Jamestown settlement that was founded in 1607. Because the agricultural economies of these early colonies demanded large labor forces, white settlers first used enslaved Native Americans and European indentured servants. Over time, the labor of enslaved Africans proved to be the most economical, and the development of chattel slavery began. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
1983, El Salvador. 2 members of the Christian community in San Ramon are abducted, tortured and shot by the national police. In September, U.S. trained death squads will bomb the Jesuit residence in San Salvador.
Okay, a brief history of events that have happened this coming week. Now onto a celebration of International Pirate Radio Day, which, fitting enough, is April 1st. The following is a 9-minute segment produced by the Emergence Broadcasting System, and it is audio portion of a Renegade Art installation opening up this Monday, March 30th. The Squatted House in Bushwick is an art space, and one of these pieces of art that are in display is a pirate radio theme. So this is 9-minute audio that is looping in this particular small corner of the space, and it is all about the history and sounds of pirate radio. And since pirate radio is radical and historical, well, I thought I'd bring a piece of it to you right now. So if you find yourself in the Bushwick neighborhood in Brooklyn, maybe we'll see you there, huh? Here's that audio.
Mm-hmm. if anything you hear on this radio station offends you in any way over the next 3 hours, please change the channel or turn the f***ing thing off.
Attention, America, this is not for you.
It's a total communications revolution. This is a lot like the printing press, which was illegal. That was a contraband item.
This is a test.
Come on down and put the handcuffs on us. The feeling that we're feeling is so damn wrong.
This is not a test.
The most dangerous frequency is an installation of pirate radio transmissions going back over 35 years. Pirates say dead men tell no tales. This is not true when it comes to pirate radio stations. Now, many of our comrades have fallen. Their messages continue to reach out. In fact, radio is an endless medium. A radio wave continues. The radio signal continues even after the transmitter and the person transmitting is long since gone. The two-dimensional radio wave carries on. In fact, the first radio signals ever done can still be heard in outer space. This installation hopes to bring you the voices of the past, the disembodied rebellion in audio format. Please stay tuned to listen to your irregularly scheduled program. This installation brought to you by the Emergent Broadcasting System.
Going back in time on the sounds of the nation, it's the Caroline Flashback.
Este es Radio Insurgente, voz del Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional, transmitiendo desde las montañas del sureste mexicano.
Oh, what this is a pirate station.
Illegal.
Illegal?
You've just crossed over from reality and entered the Rabbit Zone.
Radio Insurgente, la voz de los sin voz.
Vamos. Free Radio Santa Cruz.
89.3. 96.3 FM.
101.1 on your FM dial has been successfully flying the skull and crossbones for the past 10 years.
They say the free radio movement is just too big to stop.
101.1 FM and free radio.
The best damn station in the country, and it's all for you.
Alright, 89.3,
this is Skid Mark Bob, free radio. I don't consider myself a communist, no. Have you ever said fuck the FCC?
Oh, hello!
This is Radio POE. And from the 29th of October 2000, this station will be broadcasting in 1 second between 7 p.m. and 7:55 p.m. every night. Our address remains the same, Box CY3093, also in Harare. Radio DOT, voice of the people. Manaru Taura, the people are talking. Arantibara Kuduma.
They run a pirate radio station in Brooklyn, New York.
Well, unfortunately, troops, it's that time again for good old Pete and myself. We've just about reached the ending of another radio first sermon for tonight. And we'd like to leave you with a few closing thoughts. First off, remember, there is no black power or white power in Vietnam. There's only one power, and that's rabbit power.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. Lately, the feature presentations on This Week in Palestine have been lengthy, and we have not been able to report some of the significant new successes of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. But there has been one success that cannot go unmentioned, as reported in the following article in Mondo Weiss. British security company G4S, the world's largest, has responded to a four-year-long global BDS campaign protesting its role in Israeli violations of Palestinian human rights by announcing that it will sell its Israeli subsidiary in the coming 12 to 24 months. In describing the move, the Financial Times reported that G4S was extracting itself from reputationally damaging work. Since 2010, G4S has lost contracts worth millions of dollars in many countries following BDS pressure to end its complicity in Israeli prisons, where Palestinians are tortured and held without trial, as well as in Israeli checkpoints, settlements, and a police training center. Their lost clients include private businesses, universities, trade unions, and UN bodies. The Bill Gates Foundation in 2014 divested its $170 million stake in the company following protests at its offices in Seattle, London, and Johannesburg. In recent weeks, UNICEF in Jordan and a major restaurant chain in Colombia became the latest high-profile bodies to end their contracts with G4S following BDS campaigns. As the height of the international boycott of apartheid South Africa, BDS pressure is making some of the world's largest corporations realize that profiting from Israeli apartheid and colonialism is bad for business, said Mahmoud Nawajah, a spokesperson for the Palestinian BDS National Committee, the broadest coalition in Palestinian society that leads the BDS movement. Investment fund managers are increasingly recognizing that their fiduciary responsibility obliges them to divest from Israeli banks and companies that are implicated in Israel's serious human rights violations, such as G4S and Hewlett-Packard, because of the high risk entailed. We are starting to notice a domino effect, he added. French multinationals Veolia and Orange and CRH, Ireland's biggest company, have all exited the Israeli market in recent months, mainly as a result of BDS campaigning. United Methodist Church has put five Israeli banks on a blacklist due to their complicity in human rights violations, including the financing of illegal Israeli settlements. Palestinian lawyer Sahar Francis, director of Adamir Prison Support and Human Rights Association, commented, "We are grateful to all of the dedicated grassroots organizers around the world who are working in solidarity with Palestinians seeking freedom, justice, and equality. But G4S is infamous for breaking pledges to end its participation in Israeli crimes. Our boycott of G4S will remain among the BDS movement's top priorities until we actually see it back out of the door of Israel's regime of occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid. We also welcome the news that G4S is also selling its business that operate youth detention centers in the U.S. and the U.K., both of which have seen G4S targeted by campaigners over its abusive practices, and both of which are part of deeply racist incarceration systems. From the U.S. to Palestine, from South Africa to the U.K., G4S is deeply involved in racist mass incarceration business. We remain determined to work closely with partners to hold G4S to account for its participation in human rights abuses. G4S also has a long and documented track record of participation in human rights and workers' rights abuses elsewhere in the world, especially in prisons and migrant detention centers it has run in the U.S., the U.K., and South Africa. Now would you add it? Failing to stop the impressive growth of BDS in pursuit of freedom and justice, Israel is desperately trying to smear and delegitimize our nonviolent movement, including with anti-democratic laws in Europe and the U.S. aimed at silencing dissent and suppressing our freedom of speech. We believe strongly that our ethical approach and just cause will prevail, as this latest G4S announcement shows. In September 2015, French corporate giant Veolia sold off all its businesses in Israel. This was a direct result of a seven-year campaign against its role in infrastructure projects for illegal settlements in Israel that cost more than $20 billion in lost tenders and contracts. A leading French-based Israeli business recently told the Israeli media that the growing strength of the BDS movement means that most major European companies now avoid investing in Israel. Foreign direct investment in Israel dropped by 46% in 2014 as compared to 2013, according to a UN report, partially due to the impressive growth of the BDS impact, as stated by one of the report's authors. That was an article from the news service Mondelēz. So now we know why Israel is investing so much time, energy, and money fighting the BDS movement, including a state-by-state stealth campaign to develop legislation opposing BDS here in the United States. It is beginning to cost them money, big time, and they are lashing back. This morning, our feature presentation is by Nadia Ben-Youssef, the U.S. representative of the human rights organization and legal center, Adala. Adala means justice in Arabic and is based in Haifa. She speaks about the attempts of Adala to save a Bedouin village in the Negev of Israel, a village named al-Haran, which has been in existence since the early 1950s. Now Israel has decided to level al-Haran to build a much larger, exclusively Jewish town that will be named just Haran. The Negev is huge and mostly unpopulated, yet Israel continues its purging of Bedouin villages by choosing this particular site for a new Jewish town rather than building on much available vacant space. Nadia Ben-Youssef's presentation refers occasionally to PowerPoint images, which obviously cannot be seen by our radio audience, but most of these images simply illustrate how the new Jewish town will replace the village of al-Haran and are not central to her compelling narrative. Nadia gave this presentation at Tufts University. She is introduced by Tufts anthropology professor Amal Bishara.
Okay, I want to thank all of you for being here today, and I also want to especially thank Nadia Ben-Youssef for being here today. She's just back from Palestine, and you, like, not 48 hours, right?
Right.
And I think that really, we've all been, and those of us who've been following the story of al-Haran have been in shock since the new court case came out that after 13 years of legal struggle, this community of 1,000 people is really facing immediate displacement and demolition of their community. And you're going to hear a lot more about that, obviously, from Nadia Ben Youssef. So I'm just going to give you a little introduction to her. Since 2010, Nadia has been working with Adala, which is one of the most preeminent human rights organizations in Israel, Palestinian human rights organizations as well. And one of the big cases that they have taken on is that of the Bedouin community in the Naqab, and it's been a specialty of yours, as I understand. Before working at Adala, she's worked on human rights violations in India. She's served as a speechwriter and legal assistant to Ms. Sherry Blair, and she's also worked as a civil litigator for indigent clients in the area here, in the Boston community. She also speaks fluent French and Spanish and Arabic. For those of you who are thinking about pursuing careers in human rights law, I think this is a great opportunity for you to talk to somebody who's done it so beautifully and so successfully. She got her law degree from Boston College with a certificate in human rights and international justice. And now in the United States, she's been doing a lot of really fascinating and important solidarity work with a lot of different communities, Arab American communities, African American communities, Jewish communities, and others. She publishes in The Nation, Huffington Post, among other places. And I've just been delighted that we kind of fortuitously have you as part of the Boston community. Adala's work is moving and of vital, vital importance. And so having you here in the community to bring that here and also augment it with everything else you're doing that's not just, you know, sort of revolving around Adala is a tremendous gift. Some of you probably heard about Naqab and Umm al-Hayran last year when Suhad Bishara of Adala presented. And I just find, frankly, we should, as a community with resources and specialty and concern with this area, it's a good commitment for us to say we're going to keep following this case. We're going to know what's going on and we're going to do what we can because this is a really, really urgent case. So thank you for presenting this update and this talk on Umm al-Hayran versus Hayran.
Thank you so much. Thanks. Thank you so much for being here and spending your free block with us and being concerned about this case, learning about what's going on and seeing how we can work together. And in fact, it's a really good opportunity for me to dialogue a bit with you because we've kind of reached the end of the road in many ways. In terms of the legal work that we can do to save this village. So a lot of that is now turning, and we've had an advocacy strategy to coincide, which is the way that Adala does its work. But this is a hard story to tell. For some reason, it's a really hard story to tell. It seems very clear what's going on. It seems pretty, and I think the issue is that it's so clear that it actually seems absurd. That the case actually seems absurd. So what I'm going to do is tell you a bit about the Naqab generally, just to give a bit of background, and then we're going to go right into this case. And I'll give you legal updates, what the Supreme Court of Israel has said, and also what the community is gearing up to do, and how then maybe to think about what mobilizing here could look like. I'm interested. I have a notebook next to me. I want to hear your ideas. I want to think with you about what resonates with you as Americans, as students, as people who care about these issues, who care about social justice, so that we can maybe tailor our messaging in such a way that will be more effective. It's a devastating case. We were shocked, in fact, and it's hard to be shocked in Palestine, but we were shocked by the decision. So I'll run through this a little bit, and then hopefully, if there's something to interrupt me a bit, please feel free, and thank you again for having me. So, in fact, though, should I say, you said something about Adala, so this is good. We're going to talk about the Naqab. So this little map, put a little red square around it. The Naqab is about 60% of the land of Israel, so it's in the south, 60% of the land, 10% of Israelis live here, so it's sparsely populated. Not very many people live in the Naqab, but about 32% are Palestinian Bedouin. So just a broad overview of the demographics in Israel so that we can be clear. One in five Israelis is a Palestinian. One in five Israelis is a Palestinian. 20% of the population of Israel. Palestinians who remained in their homeland after the Nakba, after the catastrophe, after the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, and became a homeland minority, essentially. So they became citizens, all Palestinians who remained inside Israel after the state was established, became citizens in 1952, became full Israeli citizens in 1952, but lived under a military regime until 1966. And this is an interesting date if people are following dates and can think about connections. 1966, of course, you have the occupation begins in 1967. So just where we're talking about. So in the Nakba, 32% of the population is Palestinian Bedouin. And they live now about number around 200,000 people. 100,000 Palestinian Bedouin citizens of Israel live in what are called unrecognized villages. There are 35 unrecognized villages in the Nakba. And what that means, what does that mean? Also, I think this is like where this starts becoming crazy and difficult to comprehend. Unrecognized villages. Unrecognized by whom? Here's a map. Here are villages. But this is not a map of the state. This is a map by the Regional Council of the Unrecognized Villages, an organization in the Nakba, because these villages don't exist on any maps. On any maps, if you look at a map of the state of Israel, you're not going to see any of these 35 unrecognized villages. And these villages either predated the establishment of the state, so they were already here in this area, in the Nakba, before the state was established in 1948, or, and this is the case of Umm Hiran, or were created by military order when the military government of Israel concentrated the Bedouin community into a smaller area in the Nakba. They concentrated them and moved them away from their ancestral land. So when we're going to be talking about Umm Hiran here, their ancestral land is near Gaza, and they were moved here in 1956 by military order. None of that is disputed, and it becomes a really important issue in the case. Because what the state says, despite the fact that most of these villages predated the establishment of the state says, and this is really interesting, and if you're interested in law and you're interested in understanding law not as a powerful tool but as a tool of the powerful, you might find this very compelling, because legally, all of the Palestinian Bedouins are trespassers on state land. After the state was established, all of the land of the Nakba became state land. So the people who were there, even if they were there before the law suddenly declared this a state land, became trespassers. Became trespassers on state land. So their villages became illegal under Israeli law. And so they are not on any maps. They're disconnected from any basic services. No water, no electricity, no sewage, no roads, no schools, no health clinics. And these are citizens of Israel. So maybe you're thinking, what does citizenship mean? And you would be right to think that. What is the law? You would be right to think that. This is so absurd, which is why it's hard to tell this story. This is Umm Hiran. Umm Hiran. And I'm going to talk about Umm Hiran and Atiyah. So the name is the name that we said for the talk is Umm Hiran versus Hiran. And we use that because it's really quite striking. But these are twin villages. Atiyah and Umm Hiran, if you go back to this map, they're really close to each other, Atiyah and Umm Hiran, and they're from the same family, the Abu Ghiyan family, who came from the Gaza Strip, and they settled right next to each other, but in two areas, across about 7,000 dunams, four dunams to an acre, you know, just a bit, I don't know, across this area. So Atiyah and Umm Hiran. But this is the village of Hiran. Now we have about 1,000 people who live in Atiyah and Umm Hiran, into these two twin villages. In 2003, the Israeli government issued home demolition orders on all of the villages, in all of the houses of the village, an eviction lawsuit against the residents of Atiyah and Umm Hiran, and declared the houses illegal, and started preparing a plan for the village, the new town, the new settlement of Hiran. The name of the Palestinian Bedouin village is Umm al-Hiran. The name of this new Jewish town, established by the state, is called Hiran. This is from the master plan of Hiran, which is going to be was originally declared in 2003 when this was first proposed, or 2007 when it was first proposed, as an exclusively Jewish town. Exclusively Jewish town. And in fact, that can happen in the state of Israel. There can be exclusively X towns. 43% of all towns in Israel are run by, and these are small towns, so the issue is that this became a bit of a bigger town, so they can't really do exactly what they want. It's going to be about 2,000 people. But small communities in Israel can be governed by what are called admissions committees. Admissions committees are groups of five citizens. One has to be a member of the Jewish Agency, the other has to be a member of the World Zionist Organization, and these committees can decide who can enter or not into that town on the basis of the criteria, which was green-lighted by the Supreme Court of Israel. The criteria is on the basis of social suitability, whether or not someone is socially suitable to live in that town. So when this was first announced in 2007, we thought it would be governed by admissions committees that could say, this is an exclusively Jewish town. Now, because it's a larger village, and because there's been some negative press around this idea, the state is no longer saying this is exclusively Jewish, but the Supreme Court has acknowledged that it's going to be majority Jewish, and the residents, who we'll meet very soon, are actually ideological settlers originally from the West Bank who are coming into Hiran. So this is the map of Hiran, and you'll notice here is Umm al-Hiran in the purple, and it's basically right on top, right where there's going to be a residential area. So Hiran is mapped out exactly on Umm al-Hiran.
Can I ask you a question?
Please.
About the map there.
Yeah.
The purple, you all didn't add that in. It's actually in their official map?
Yeah. So standing houses to be demolished. It's in their map.
It's in their map.
And they're like, I don't know. There's some homes here. And can I... Here's a pause. I'm telling you, it's so absurd. 2012, I was at the Southern District Planning Committee in Beersheba in the south of Israel. And we're there discussing Hiran. And the lead urban planner for this village of Hiran was there. He's from Tel Aviv. And he was there, and he was with his team. And you're in the interior ministry, so you can't use like cameras or recorders or anything. This dude was taking pictures of our dear colleague Suhad Bishara, who's the lead lawyer on the case, taking pictures of her and like watching her speak. And she was telling the story of Umm al-Hiran. And so I was like so upset that this was happening. And after this hearing, and I'm telling you this just because it makes this look, anyway, the guy comes up to Suhad, and he's like, I had no idea. I had no idea about this case. I've never been. I've never been to this area. And when I looked on a map, there is no such thing as Umm al-Hiran. And when I looked at our plan, it was just these standing structures to be demolished. So he was shocked, which I just find so tragic. So tragic. But the rest of the team had been there, they knew about it, and they went forward anyway. Does anyone read Hebrew in this class? Here's where it gets even crazier. It says Hiran. It says Hiran. What's happening here is in 2014, we're preparing for the Supreme Court decision, and we're in the village, and there had been rumors for about 2 years that the settlers who were going to live in Umm al-Hiran were already there, living in a nearby forest, waiting for the demolition of the village. And we asked the residents of Umm al-Hiran, like, have you seen them? And they said, no, like, I mean, we did like a 2-kilometer radius, like, I don't know, there's no settlers. We were taking affidavits from the community for the Supreme Court hearing. Oh, Lord. And Ali Aboulgian comes rushing in to Suhad, and he's like, I found them. We found them. And she was like, what? And so had got in the Jeep. It was night. And she got in the Jeep, and she came back, and she was shaking. She was like, you would not believe what I saw. They're there. They're waiting. And we were like, what? Crazy. So the next day, I went as like an undercover journalist. I was terrible. But this is what we saw. This is what's in the middle of the forest, in Yatir Forest. So on, but it's on the 48, on the Israeli side of the Green Line. All this, again, is happening inside Israel. You go, and there's a big military gate, and you have a proper community. A proper community, there's electricity, there's water, there's recycling services, and there's this amazing bus stop, that in Hebrew says it's the regional council of Mount Hebron. What? Hebron, in the West Bank. The regional council of Mount Hebron. Hebron is a very important and vicious settlement of Jewish Israelis who live there. So it's very interesting what's happening. Just for Americans, I think this is important. This mobile home was made possible through the generosity of JNF USA and its commitment to Blueprint Negev. JNF, the Jewish National Fund, is one of the premier Jewish institutions in the world, and it's usually known for afforestation plans. I'm not sure why I put this here, but essentially it's to remind us again of the, no, I don't know, maybe it's to show you where we are. This is Yatir HaMehran, this is Lev Yatir, this is what where the settlement is located. I want to show you a video if I can, and then we'll move quickly, I hope. Is this okay? Interesting? So we made this video when we went to see... So Adana has represented Yatir HaMehran, the two villages, through the entire legal system in Israel. And in May of 2015, the Supreme Court said, go ahead, to the state, it's fine. Any attempts that we had made to cancel the eviction orders, to cancel the home demolition orders were denied. And amazingly, the court says this is not the address for creating chaos. So don't bring us this case. What's interesting here is, Lord, what's not interesting here? The major way that we can use the legal system in Israel, particularly with regard to the Bedouin, the fact that we'll use in order to challenge demolition orders or eviction lawsuits, we have to deal with two primary arguments of the state, which I mentioned at the beginning, that they're trespassers. The Bedouin are trespassers, so they're lawbreakers according to the laws of Israel. So we're not going to do anything exceptional to help you out. You're a trespasser. The second is that this land where you are, Bedouin, and this is kind of it's a very interesting argument, is not suitable for residential use. So even if we wanted you to stay there, and maybe we do, it's not good for you. It's not good for you, Bedouin, so you need to leave. This case, Adala was able to prove through archives, military documents, exactly what I said, so that the military moved these people here in 1956 and gave them the 7,000 dunams of land. So they weren't trespassers, and the court had to accept it. And the court did accept it. And as to the second argument, that this is not suitable for residential use, the plan of Hiran disproves that pretty easily. In fact, it is a beautifully suitable place for residential use if you're the right kind of resident. If you're the right kind of resident. So in the decision, basically the court said, and this was a 2-1 decision, so there's 15 justices on the Supreme Court. Oftentimes in cases like this, you would think you would have an expanded panel to address this pretty clearly discriminatory policy of demolishing one village because the residents are Palestinian or Bedouin and replacing it with the Jewish community. They didn't get to that issue. Even the dissenting judge, didn't get to that issue. She said, you know, she thought maybe that the Bedouin might have some rights, but nonetheless, it's not about discrimination. They said, listen, Okay, you're not trespassers. We did give you the land, but it's public land, so we can take it back. We can take it back. So they said, it's ours. We can do with it what we would. And alternatives exist. So what does that mean? The plan of the state for the Bedouin is to move them into a nearby town. It's a township called Hura. So in the Naqab, I remember there was 200,000 people, 100,000 live in unrecognized villages. The other 100,000 live in either what are called recently recognized villages, these are villages that since 2003 have been recognized by the state, or government-planned towns. There are 7 government-planned towns, and they are the poorest in Israel, highest rates of crime, of poverty, no industry. It reminds me in many ways of a kind of a reservation policy. These are towns where you drive through them and you're like, what is this? Like, this doesn't look like any other town that I know. And so these towns, there are 7 of them. Hura is one of them. The plan is to move them to Hura. So they said, listen, there's an alternative. You can go. And that was the decision of the Supreme Court. We requested a second hearing in July. One, for the expanded panel that I mentioned, to have more people look at this case. And 2, asking, because it's an extraordinary decision, to demolish an entire village, displace 1,000 people in order to create the town of Hiran. And I haven't spoken about it much, but in Atir, the plan is to level the village of Atir, which is nearby, and to expand the Yatir forest. So it'll be expanded forest and grazing land for Hiran. This line, I think, in January is difficult to read. And it's more difficult because of the next slide I'm going to show you. In the court said, this case is not one that can be considered to be exceptionally exceptional, the rarest of rare, to warrant another hearing. And they denied our hearing, our request. I just want to, this, we haven't released this yet. We're releasing it today. And I'll tell you why and what's happening on the ground. But as we were kind of racking our brains after this decision, looking at Supreme Court precedents, we went back like 2 months to August. So the case was in May. The original decision was in May. In August, 3 months later, the Supreme Court issued this crazy decision. So we've made this infographic in the last week called the Zeltzers versus Atiro Manera. So the story of the Zeltzers is a family of 5 that live near Jerusalem. And there's a plan to, they have state permission to live here. They were given permission. And the plan around Jerusalem is to expand a forest. So another afforestation plan. And it would be over their home, over their home. So they lived there since 1974. They have permission to live there, and now there's a new plan. This is a family of 5. And they went to the Supreme Court, similar process, you know, challenging the plan. Then they went to the Supreme Court to say, this is an except to, you know, the how dare you state. And this is the line that was used by the Israeli Supreme Court in August of 2015. This case before us is a very special and unique case. And the court decided the family should stay and the state should reconsider its plans. The family should stay and the state should reconsider its plans. The implications of this decision are huge. There are, again, 35 unrecognized villages. Basically, what the Supreme Court has said is, I mean, this is our strongest case in the Naqab. Adala does what's called impact litigation. So we look for the strongest case that's going to have a wide impact on a lot of people. Or we're taking cases that challenge large policies. So we are really strategic about the cases that we choose. And we're really cautious about land cases in Israel. Because land and citizenship are the foundational issues of the state, and the state really can't let go of its control over those 2 kind of realms of the polity. So we took this case specifically. They're not trespassers. They were moved here by the state. This is a clearly discriminatory plan. Jewish citizen versus Palestinian citizen, Jewish privilege, very, very clearly laid out. So we were shocked to lose this case, really. And often, like again, we're not usually that shocked because it's a disaster. And we're using essentially a colonial legal regime. And how do you use the law of the oppressor to protect the rights of the oppressed? It's very difficult, and we know that. But we took this case because we thought we could win. We didn't win. And so there are 35 unrecognized villages throughout the Naqab, 70,000 people who live there. There's a green light precedent to demolish all of those villages, which is just insane. It's insane, but it's not out of the ordinary, and it's not even out of Israel's intentions. In 2011, they passed this Proverb plan. I don't know if anyone heard of this Proverb plan. It was basically a large government plan to do exactly that, to demolish all of the 35 unrecognized villages and concentrate the Bedouin into those townships, the seven townships or the recently recognized towns. And we fought that mostly like through community mobilization, organizing, challenging the plan, and it was shelved in December of 2013. It was shelved. So the Supreme Court steps in and says, I'll give you a way to do that. I don't know if this is... I mean, basically, it's pretty clear, but this case, we also raised this in the January case because in the request for an exceptional hearing. If anyone is familiar with the disengagement plan of 2005, taking Israeli settlers out of the Gaza Strip, those settlers were there, again, illegally. Settlements are illegal under international law. They were there illegally. They were disengaged, this big disengagement from Gaza. And they went to the Supreme Court to say, yep, this is a violation of our constitutional rights to property and dignity. And the Supreme Court said, you know, right, you're right. Yes, this is a violation of dignity to lose your land in this way. And you should be compensated justly. So we brought that to the court. No constitutional rights were violated. If you're a Palestinian, your constitutional rights are conditional. Your constitutional rights are conditional. So are they meaningful at all? Again, you know, the alternatives, the compensation, the alternatives are for the people of Umm al-Hiran to move into Houra. Recently, the mayor of Houra, this government township, said, we can't take you in. We can't take, even if we wanted to take you in, and we don't want to because we want the Bedouin to be able to stay with dignity on their land. But even if we wanted to, we can't take you in. So the alternatives, which is a case that we brought in successfully, actually, one of the most only successful cases in the Naqab, in 2011, a village called Al-Sira. And Al-Sira was meant to be demolished. We went to the court, got to the district court, and they said, there's no suitable alternative, so you can't just demolish this village of 350 people. So we've been able to challenge that alternative discourse, but again, not here. Tomorrow, on the ground, there's a mass demolition. No.
Lord.
Freud, disaster demonstration. There's a mass demonstration planned on the ground. It's called Not Leaving. And basically, that's all that's left. And we are now in the process of kind of pushing for international action and trying to see if we can somehow pressure the state from international voices. So we'll be doing a lot, and we have been, which is what makes this pretty exhausting, at the UN, at the EU, in the United States. But we need to do a bit more, and we can do a bit more. And ultimately, you have to believe, and I do believe, that this is where it matters. The courts are one tool. The law is one tool, absolutely. But it's not the only tool. And the people of Umm al-Hiran also believe that the law is not the only tool, which is why they're continuing to mobilize. These are some of the calls that we're putting forward to the international community. And I'm interested now. I mean, I think I'll stop to hear your reactions. Again, I'm taking notes because I think we're in a bit of a disaster situation. And not to be so dramatic, Palestine is not generally a very disaster-free zone. But it is really, really important. And it's important to find a way to distill this story within your communities, within your schools, within your places of worship. Distill this community to its essence and to really consider the fact that we're going to allow this to happen, that this happens on our watch, that we are supportive or we are accepting of a state that says, if you're a certain kind of person, you have rights. If you're not a certain kind of person, you don't. And do we accept that? Do we accept that? And I know we don't. And I know that you don't. I know you're here for a specific reason. But this is a test case, not on Israel, not for Palestinians, but for all of us. It's a test case. So thank you so much for listening, and I'm interested in your reactions. Thank you.
That was a presentation by Nadia Ben Youssef of the human rights organization Adala, speaking about the systematic suppression of the Bedouin people in the Israeli Negev. And finally, before we wrap it up this week, I want to play a quick interview of an amazing Palestinian journalist, author, and playwright, Rula Jubril, conducted by Max Blumenthal. The interview took place before the conference at the National Press Club organized by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, parts of which we hope to feature on This Week in Palestine in the future. Rula Jubril speaks about the AIPAC conference, the Arab Spring, and the bias of the U.S. media. It is only 3 minutes long, but it is a gem.
You know, Monday you have this big event with AIPAC is basically dismantling the principle of democracy because they're waging, you know, a war on diversity. But basically what they're saying, we can buy whatever we want. Your policies belong to us.
Where are we now? Because a few years ago we were so hopeful about the Arab Spring maybe leading to Jerusalem.
My hope is not from the Arab nation somehow. The main actor in aborting the Arab Spring was Saudi Arabia, who financed every coup in the region because they were so concerned that the arrival of democratic system will reach Jeddah and Riyadh and people will start demanding more inclusive and negotiated system. Look, it took the American Constitution to be ratified 7 years until the Battle of Yorktown. I don't know how long it will take the Arab nations to become more inclusive, but I think now there's something that happened with the Iran deal that will force the region, and they produce no stability, Saudi Arabia. It's only a liability. It's time to break that bond.
Now, you've seen it from the inside. We met when you were driven off of MSNBC for pointing out that U.S. media is biased towards Israel. It seems obvious. It's like saying water's wet and the sky is blue and Judas told the Romans where Jesus slept. A CNN executive admitted that he helped write Netanyahu's speech to Congress.
Exactly. And then when I'm invited in CNN or in any other network, they always call me very worried. So what are you going to talk about? What are you... And they are so worried to tell the audience the truth about what's going on, because they know that this will lead to shift in public opinion. But because of people like yourself, because of Alternet, it's because of Salon, it's because of Intercept, it's because of MondoWise, it's because of these amazing...
Electronic Intifada.
Electronic Intifada and Ali Abu Na'ma, who actually started all of this movement and part of this movement. And without these voices, incredible voices, I mean, I would have been shunned aside and disappeared I would have became a ghost probably. But today they cannot ignore these voices. These people, obviously, I shamed them in public. They couldn't take it. They're busy with petty small things. And now they're all shocked that we have Donald Trump. But they paved the way for Donald Trump and the Islamophobia, racism, misogyny. That culture has been there and they've been bred and cultivated by major analysts in this country. So it doesn't define me what happened in that episode, but it defines its shameful, stain on MSNBC forever.
That was Palestinian journalist and author Rula Jubril. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Or if you wish to hear the program later in the day or within a two-week period via the WZBC archive, simply access the WZBC homepage and click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. If you miss a program on the WZBC archive, and remember, it is only on this archive for 2 weeks, you can find any of our past broadcasts on our permanent archive, meticulously maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. To reach our permanent archive to hear any past broadcast, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. All our past broadcasts are on the truthandjusticeradio.org archive. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when our featured presentation will be by anthropologist and author Jessica Winiger, who will discuss her controversial book, Anthropology's Politics, Disciplining the Middle East. That is next Sunday on This Week in Palestine. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you. My shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp foggy
You're listening to episode 736 of Unwelcome Guests, Why 9/11 is Still the Issue. I'm Robin Upton, and 14 and a bit years since we started to look at the events of September the 11th, we still keep turning up new angles on the event. This time we're going to be looking at the institutional silence on 9/11. We're going to be focusing on the legal structures such as exist, the UN in particular, supposed to be preventing wars. We've seen a decade and a half, near enough, of aggressive wars masked as defence. Our first contributor to the show, law lecturer Amy Baker Benjamin, asks, how can that be possible? It's not a lack of historical precedent, as we shall hear. Almost all the wars of the 20th century were begun with some sort of false flag incident. Now, this paper's no longer online, but in my academically educated opinion, makes a quite compelling and very well referenced case explaining why the UN and the academic community in particular have really failed to get to grips with the events of 9/11. I'm reading the paper, which was put online in January 2016. 9/11 as false flag. Why international law must dare to care. By Amy Baker Benjamin, a lecturer in public international law at AUT University Law School, who received her law degree from Yale Law School. Abstract. At the heart of contemporary international law lies a paradox.
The attacks on the United States of September the 11th, 2001, have justified nearly 15 years of international law, yet the official international community, embodied principally in the United Nations, has failed to question or even scrutinize the US government's account of those attacks. Despite the impressive and serious body of literature that has emerged to suggest that 9/11 was a classic, if unprecedentedly monstrous, false flag attack, international statesmen, following the lead of scholars, have acted as if there is no controversy whatsoever. This disconnect between the growing alternative evidentiary record of state responsibility for the attacks and the focus of international institutions is impossible to sustain if those institutions are to maintain any semblance of viability and meaning. In a three-step process, this article seeks to connect the international community to the possible reality of 9/11 as false flag. First, it shows that it is highly rational to question the official 9/11 account, given the historical record of the first half of the 20th century, which reveals a pattern of false flag attacks over which the international community openly fretted and tried to exercise jurisdiction. Second, it analyzes the reasons why intellectual elites and the statesmen they influence are behaving irrationally in not inquiring into the possibility of 9/11 as false flag, deconstructing a multifaceted motive into all its unsavory parts. Third, it argues that the means for ceasing this irrational behavior is readily available, as the United Nations need only carry out its core and incontrovertible jury function of determining the existence of aggression in order to exercise a long overdue oversight of the official 9/11 narrative. Introduction. No matter what one may think about the nature of the attacks that took place in the United States on September the 11th, 2001, one thing is beyond dispute. Those attacks have provided the legal, political, and moral justifications for nearly 15 years of international war. Indeed, it is not an exaggeration to say that, with few exceptions, all use of force roads laid since the beginning of this century lead back to the Rome of 9/11. These would include the 2001 invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, the 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq, the series of drone strikes here, cluster bombings there, the current mission to degrade and defeat ISIL in Iraq and Syria, and even the recently rumored need to re-intervene in Libya at some point now that it has become a failed state that may be in the business of harboring terrorists. Each one of these military campaigns is based on the legal authorization and moral dispensation granted by domestic and international authorities in the days following 9/11 to respond to the attacks of that day. Ask today for the legal basis of fighting a global war on terror against groups that were not even in existence in 2001, and you'll be handed a copy of the law passed just 7 days after 9/11, authorizing the President to use force against the perpetrators and abettors of 9/11, i.e. Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Challenge the wisdom of fighting a war on terror to the end of a second decade, and you will likely be chided for inviting a terror attack on a par with, or even worse than, 9/11. From the standpoint of international law and international political morality, then, 9/11 presumes to shoulder the heaviest of loads, a monumental amount of war to date, with apparently a good deal of war still to come. We would do well to remind ourselves, however, that this shouldering is only as strong and effective as the claim of self-defense on which it is based. The war on terror is, after all, a war that is claimed to be fought in self-defense, Were this claim ever to be proved false, were it ever to be shown that the United States was not, in fact, attacked by others on 9/11, but rather attacked itself, or let itself be attacked, for the purpose of blaming others and justifying international war, then its war would not be one of self-defense, but of premeditated and carefully camouflaged aggression. Further, all subsequent events of terror deemed connected to 9/11 through the inchoate skein of violence that flowed from it, Madrid's 3/11, London's 7/7, Paris's 1/7 and 11/13, would immediately become suspect as representing aspects of the same foundational fraud. In this sensitive matter especially, the obvious bears repeating. If 9/11 is in fact an instance of Machiavellian state terror, then any U.S. pretense that these wars have to do with self-defense is totally unsustainable. Precisely because so much is at stake, one would think that international institutions such as the United Nations would have been keenly interested in satisfying themselves that the American claim of self-defense is valid. But, astonishingly enough, they have never shown any such interest. In the days and weeks following 9/11, the UN accepted without hesitation or scrutiny the American claim to have been attacked by elements of international terrorism. NATO more or less followed suit, even though the peremptory nature of its mutual self-defense pact obliged it to probe the validity of the American self-defense claim, not merely rubber stamp it. Moreover, despite the impressive body of serious literature that has emerged since 9/11 challenging the official version of the attacks and strongly suggesting that they were either perpetrated by elements of the US government or allowed by them to happen, neither the UN nor NATO has ever bestirred itself to revisit the crucial issue of responsibility and authorship. This reluctance to ask hard questions in the halls of international institutions that are charged with the duty to go there and vet claims of national self-defense has unfortunately been matched, non-discourse for non-discourse, by the silence of scholars. It is really quite astonishing. Scholars as a group scurry away from the controversy surrounding the official version of 9/11 as if it were the intellectual equivalent of kryptonite. This is not to say, of course, that they reject 9/11 as an object of study. Quite the contrary, they've embraced it, but only so far and only in a highly circumscribed way. Scholars specializing in international law or international relations, for example, have generated hundreds, if not thousands, of articles and books on 9/11, but almost all such studies assume the correctness of the core US claim of self-defense, and then proceed to nibble on issues that lie around its perimeter. Do the laws of war apply to a war on terror that features, on one side, non-state actors? Can the 9/11 attacks support a paradigm shift away from anticipatory self-defense to preventative self-defense? Can the torture of terror suspects be justified on a warfare approach to counter-terrorism, as opposed to a crime approach, and vice versa? All good questions these, but they uniformly assume a US government-friendly answer to the most pressing question of all. Was the United States the victim of attacks by others, or was 9/11 a false flag? If the latter, then these scholars are not merely feeding on downstream phenomenon, they're boxing at shadows projected onto the cave wall by a calculating and highly dangerous criminal elite. A good deal of academic ink has also been spilled studying 9/11 as a conspiracy theory phenomenon. The scholars who author this literature many of whom practice in the social sciences, but there are a few lawyers as well, regard those who question the official version of 9/11 as conspiracy theorists who should not under any circumstances be engaged on their evidentiary claims, but rather objectified and studied in an effort to ascertain the cause of their distemper. Even scholars who concede that the U.S. government has engaged in heinous acts of state terror in the past, including a proposal at the highest level of government during the Kennedy administration to commit false flag attacks against American citizens for the purpose of justifying war against Cuba, refuse to dwell on such episodes or draw any conclusions from them relative to the evidentiary debate concerning 9/11, which they resolutely refuse to participate in. Surely academia has reached some sort of level of the absurd when not even Marxist scholars will entertain doubts about the official 9/11 account, and when a respected Swiss historian, who wishes merely to subject that account to academic scrutiny, is reduced to pleading with his colleagues, "Wir müssen über die Vergangenheit sprechen." We must talk about the past. Indeed. We are, it seems, at a stalemate, one that I hope to soften and perhaps break. My main contention is that, however long Americans might domestically be prepared to live with a no decision regarding the official 9/11 account, international law can no longer tolerate it. The core mission of the premier public international body, the United Nations, is to perform its jury function of determining whether an act of aggression has occurred. Pretextual self-defense based on a false flag event is almost by definition aggression, even if the collective security role of the UN system, as reflected in the second half of Article 39 of the Charter, seems to have withered on the vine and to now be worth little. The UN's jury role, as reflected in the first half of Article 39, remains firmly intact. Article 39, by the way, reads, quote, "The Security Council shall determine the existence of any threat to the peace, breach of the peace, or act of aggression, and make recommendations or decide what measures shall be taken in accordance with Articles 41 and 42 to maintain or restore international peace and security," unquote. Importantly, and as I will show below, this is true regardless of whether this jury role is viewed as being rooted in the positive law of Article 39 or in the pre-charter customary international law. For the UN's political organs to ignore the controversy surrounding the events of 9/11 is to abdicate all responsibility in fulfilling their core mission. It is, in a sense, to deny their own raison d'être. This, indeed, is an outcome to be avoided, if at all possible. But is it possible? Can the UN's political organs finally, after all these years, muster the will to pass judgment on the US claim to have been the victim of international terrorism on 9/11? They certainly can, but they obviously need some help. Members of those bodies, along with the scholars whose works infuse the atmosphere in which they deliberate, must first confront the reasons for their silence and abdication of duty to date. An awakening of sorts is needed, and it can only come to pass on the basis of collective self-understanding.
In an effort to prompt such understanding, I will argue that officialdom and scholars appear to be in the grip of an intellectual formalism every bit as vice-like as the Lochner-era formalism American law students are taught to frown upon and deride from the very first moment of their studies. This formalism functions in the nature of a gatekeeper, letting some ideas, issues, and facts into our minds, and from there into the public domain, while sternly barring others. As for what lies back of this formalism, lending it its terrible strength, two sadly plausible guesses emerge: fear and its handmaiden, corruption. But perhaps the best, because the easiest, place to begin in an effort to break the 9/11 stalemate will not be with the international political mechanics of change, see Infra Part 3, nor with the critical inspection, see Infra Part 2, but with an appeal to history. The case of 9/11 is so fraught with anger and ignorance as to be almost paralyzing. Whether we passively listen or actively turn away, all that many of us hear are disturbing sounds and cries, claiming to have evidence of unspeakable acts. Historical events that lie in the past, however, are far less threatening and therefore far more instructive. And so I will suggest that the first step in trying to break the 9/11 paralysis is to recognize that international law and political institutions have long been concerned with the danger of nation-states committing false flag attacks in order to justify or prepare for international war. To that history I now turn. Part 1. Why it is rational to care. A. Manchuria, Reichstag fire, Gleiwitz. From the start of the Cold War through to the present day, international political and legal bodies have had to deal with many dodgy claims of self-defense. However, almost all such claims have involved acts of either anticipatory self-defense or collective self-defense counter-intervention. This can obscure the fact that during a more distant time period, namely the 20-year interregnum of the interwar period and the immediate aftermath of World War II, international concern was focused to a large extent on pretextual claims of self-defense based on false flag attacks. It is sobering to recall that the first major crisis to strike the UN's predecessor organization, the League of Nations, was an international invasion by one state of another based on a highly dubious claim of having been attacked. In 1931, Japan invaded the northeastern Chinese province of Manchuria, claiming that Chinese nationalists had sabotaged portions of a railway line controlled and operated by it near the city of Mukden. Though the explosion was so weak that it failed to destroy the track, the Japanese army immediately accused the Chinese dissidents of the attack and responded with a full-scale invasion that led to the occupation of Manchuria and the installation of a puppet regime within 6 months. Historian Walter Lefebvre makes short work of any doubts as to what actually occurred, writing that, in the hours immediately following the explosion, quote, "fighting broke out between Japanese and Chinese troops. By the morning, the Japanese army held Mukden and was expanding its control over surrounding territory. Its officers claimed that the bomb had been set by the Chinese and even conveniently spread several Chinese bodies around the explosion site. But authorities in Tokyo and other world capitals quickly concluded that the army had blown up its own tracks as an excuse to conquer Manchuria." Unquote. Upon China's complaint of illegal aggression by Japan, the League of Nations seized itself of the matter and sent a commission to Manchuria to investigate. Although remarkably even-handed in its assessment of blame for the generally tense situation in Manchuria between the Japanese army and the Chinese populace, the Lytton Commission left no doubt that Japan's claim of having had its railroad attacked was false. Quote, "The Japanese, as was explained to the Commission in evidence, had a carefully prepared plan to meet the case of possible hostilities between themselves and the Chinese. On the night of the explosion, this plan was put into operation with swiftness and precision. The Chinese had no plan of attacking the Japanese troops or of endangering lives or property of Japanese nationals at this particular time or place. They made no concerted or authorized attack on the Japanese forces and were surprised by the Japanese attack and subsequent operations, an explosion undoubtedly occurred on or near the railroad between 10 p.m. and 10:30 p.m. on September the 18th, but the damage, if any, to the railroad did not in fact prevent the punctual arrival of the southbound train from Changchun, and was not in itself sufficient to justify military action. The military operations of the Japanese troops during this night cannot be regarded as measures of legitimate self-defense. In saying this, the Commission does not exclude the hypothesis that the officers on the spot may have thought that they were acting in self-defense. Unquote. However mild the rebuke, the Japanese knew an insult when they heard one, and abruptly withdrew from the League in 1933. Years later, following the carnage of Japanese aggression during World War II, the Tokyo International Military Tribunal heard evidence on the Mukden incident and forthrightly concluded what the Lytton Commission had been too gentlemanly to state. Quote, "The evidence is abundant and convincing that the Mukden incident was carefully planned beforehand by officers of the Army General Staff, officers of the Kwantung Army, members of the Cherry Society, and others. The tribunal rejects the Japanese contention and holds that the so-called incident of 18th of September 1931 was planned and executed by the Japanese." Unquote. This, then, was the sneaky face of aggression in a world where aggressive war had ceased to be regarded as a legitimate instrument of national policy. As the Japanese well understood, by 1931, a state could no longer legitimately say, "We want their territory, let's take it," as Germany had effectively said to France 60 years earlier, in 1870, when they had gobbled up French-owned Alsace-Lorraine in a bid to craft a unified German nation-state. No, by 1931, courtesy of the League's collective security system and the 1928 Kellogg-Briand Pact, which denied states the right to wage aggressive war, a nation would have to fake it in order to get away with it. Hitler, of course, had been watching and taking notes on Manchuria, and when he decided to invade Poland in 1939, he felt he needed to create a veneer of self-defensive indignation before sending his already primed army over international borders. Thus ensued what has come to be known as the Gliwice incident. To create the appearance of Polish aggression against Germany, Hitler's lieutenants had German troops dress up as Poles and attack German installations along the German-Polish border. As Whitney Harris describes it, by August 1939, Hitler, quote, "was left with no alternative but to attack Poland and to fight England and France as well. Still, he had no excuse for war. The Poles were not threatening Germany with military force. It was Germany who was rattling the sabre. Lacking an excuse, Hitler proceeded to fabricate one. Early in August 1939, a plan had been conceived for this purpose by the Chief of the Security Police and SD, Heydrich, to stage simulated border raids by personnel of the Gestapo and SD dressed as Poles. To add authenticity, it was planned to take certain prisoners from concentration camps, kill them by the use of hypodermic injections, and leave their bodies, clad in Polish uniforms, at the various places where the incidents supposedly were to occur. On August the 31st, these border incidents were staged at Beuthen, Hindenburg, Gliwice, and elsewhere." Unquote. The Gliwice incident was not forgotten by the United States or its allies during the course of World War II. In fact, after the war, they specifically included it in the Bill of Particulars on the conspiracy charge levelled against the major Nazi war criminals at Nuremberg, and the Nuremberg Tribunal heard affidavit testimony regarding it. There is further tantalising evidence to suggest that the lessons drawn by the Allies from the Gliwice incident, the foremost being that false flag attacks do occur, shaped the debate about the scope of the right of self-defense under the new UN system being planned at the end of the war in San Francisco. Commenting on the drafting history of Article 51 of the UN Charter, Thomas Frank noted, quote, "Even the terminology eventually agreed upon, preserving states' inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the United Nations, Article 51, was criticized by Archibald MacLeish within the US delegation as too vague. He recalled that Germany had entered Poland at the beginning of the present war on the pretext that Poland had attacked her." Unquote. Perhaps one reason why so few people outside Germany believed Hitler at the time regarding his claim of Polish aggression, and why after the war some statesmen seemed preoccupied with the issue of false flags justifying aggression, was because people remembered the occurrence of a notorious false flag event early in the Nazi reign, to wit, the Reichstag fire of 1933. The story is relatively straightforward. The Nazis set fire to the German parliament, the Reichstag, but blamed the crime on a group of communists in order to justify a mass political witch hunt of the German left, the termination of political and civil liberties for the citizenry at large, and the seizure of totalitarian political control over Germany. What's important about this false flag for our purposes is the extent to which it was viewed, both at the time and years later at Nuremberg, as an act of state terror having international ramifications. The Nazis, after all, had made no secret of their irredentist designs on the post-war peace of Europe as enshrined in the Versailles Settlement, and it was generally believed that any event which would enable them to seize power within Germany would also enable them to begin their march toward the use of aggressive war to redraw the map of Europe. The feeling was ripe that the international community, in some way, shape, or form, had to become involved in litigating the facts of the Reichstag fire. The upshot of this international concern was the convening of a citizen-initiated legal commission of inquiry in London in September 1933, shortly before the commencement of the actual trial of the communist defendants in Germany. Doubting the ability or willingness of the German judiciary to afford the defendants a fair trial, the London Commission resolved to hear evidence in the matter and came to a verdict regarding responsibility. The judges and jurors were 9 public-spirited international lawyers, including Arthur Garfield Hayes, co-founder of the American Civil Liberties Union. The London Commission, which in key respects should be regarded as the precursor of the many 9/11 truth movements and international citizens' inquiries that have striven to investigate the 9/11 case, such as the 2011 Toronto hearings, quickly concluded that the Nazis had torched the Reichstag. 12 years later, the Nuremberg Tribunal agreed that the crime of the Reichstag fire was relevant to proof of a crime of international dimension, i.e. the crime of aggression, and heard evidence of Nazi responsibility for it. B. Operation Northwoods and the larger historical context. Jim Garrison, the New Orleans prosecutor, who for years tried to investigate the assassination of President Kennedy, once remarked, quote, "I'm afraid, based on my own experience, that fascism will come to America in the name of national security." Unquote. He was perhaps closer to the truth than he realized, for it was during the Kennedy administration that senior U.S. military officials proposed a false flag terror operation to justify international war with Cuba that would have made the likes of Reinhard Heydrich proud indeed. The plan was called Operation Northwoods, and it entailed the following. Quote, "The plan, which had the written approval of the chairman and every member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, called for innocent people to be shot on American streets, for boats carrying refugees from Cuba to be sunk on the high seas, for a wave of violent terrorism to be launched in Washington, D.C., Miami, and elsewhere. People would be framed for bombings they did not commit, planes would be hijacked. Using phony evidence, all of it would be blamed on Castro, thus giving the Joint Chiefs of Staff chairman, Lyman Lemnitzer, and his cabal the excuse, as well as the public and international backing, they needed to launch their war. Unquote. As described by James Bamford, quote, Northwoods included proposals for false flag attacks of sabotage of the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, the sinking of a U.S. Navy ship in the Guantanamo Bay harbor, casualty lists for which, it was hoped, quote, would help cause a helpful wave of national indignation, unquote, the blowing up of John Glenn's rocket ship during his historic spaceflight, and a highly elaborate deception for simulating the shooting down of civilian airplanes, which involved the retrofitting of aircraft by the CIA, secret landings and disembarkation of passengers, and the surreptitious substitution of drones for aircraft. On behalf of the Joint Chiefs, Lemnitzer submitted the Northwoods plan to President Kennedy's Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, whereupon it was summarily quashed. Manchuria, the Reichstag fire, and the Gleiwitz incident were all undisputed, fully executed false flags, but none of them resulted in mass, or even many, casualties. Northwoods, on the other hand, gets us far closer to 9/11 in terms of an historical precedent, as it would have involved multiple theatres of operation and hundreds, perhaps even thousands, of innocent victims. Moreover, when set within the context of two larger and closely related categories of state malfeasance, namely false flags used for domestic political purposes and false pretenses for war not involving use of false flags, the 9/11 false flag scenario becomes scarily thinkable and, if you will, speakable. As to the former category, we have strong evidence that the U.S. government, acting through NATO, orchestrated mass casualty false flag terrorism against the civilian populations of Western Europe in order to discredit the European left. As to the latter category, we have strong evidence that the U.S. government lied about being attacked in order to commence full-scale war against North Vietnam in 1964, and lied about the danger of being attacked in order to commence war against Iraq in 2003. Both sets of lies resulted in wars in which vast numbers of innocent people perished. Putting all these pieces together, what emerges is a horrifying mosaic showing the very real possibility of a mass casualty false flag attack being executed to justify international war. To dismiss this possibility out of hand, or to deny the right and duty of the international community to investigate it, is nothing short of irrational. Part 2. Why we haven't cared thus far. Why, then, are so many of us behaving irrationally? Why haven't we, scholars, statesmen, bureaucrats, the mainstream press, been willing to scrutinize the facts of 9/11 to determine if that event wasn't a modern-day Operation Northwoods? We look at 9/11, yet we choose not to see it. We treat it as a taboo subject, yet one of our own making. Using the language of litigation, we might say that although the official 9/11 account has been repeatedly indicted by alternative 9/11 literature and investigation, a trial has failed to take place. Indeed, we've taken this indictment, one that the historical record tells us is perfectly reasonable on its face, and quashed it for its failure to charge a cognizable offence. Similarly, if 9/11 alternativism were a civil claim sounding in tort, we have, in effect, granted the government's motion to throw it out for a failure to state a claim, when in fact it could hardly survive a government motion for summary judgment. The question almost asks itself, why are we doing this? Why are we being so summarily dismissive of charges to the official account? This is a sensitive topic, and again, before we broach it relative to ourselves, it might be easier to broach it in a safer way, historically and relative to our ancestors. Let us, in effect, gore their ox, and then perhaps we might be willing to gore our own. A. Lochner-era formalism and Pound's legal monks. One of the rites of passage for nearly every American law student who studies constitutional law is to learn about the sordid tale of Lochner-era formalism. The term derives from the 1905 case Lochner v. New York, in which the U.S. Supreme Court declared unconstitutional a New York state law that limited the number of hours each day a baker could work. The Supreme Court rejected New York's argument that the law was necessary to protect the health of bakers, calling it, quote, an unreasonable, unnecessary, and arbitrary interference with the right of the individual to enter into those contracts in relation to labor which may seem to him appropriate or necessary, unquote. During the 30 years that followed Lochner, until its decision in West Coast Hotel Company v. Parrish,
the court persisted in striking down state and federal laws that sought to protect the welfare of workers. The formalism of which the justices stood accused by their critics, both at the time and since, amounted to an intellectual insulation from social facts that kept them from appreciating the realities of modern industrial relations. Those realities fatefully disadvantaged workers in contract negotiations with their would-be employers and rendered talk of freedom of contract cruelly farcical. By refusing to gaze upon those realities and draw the necessary inferences from them in assessing protective legislation, the justices were, in Roscoe Pound's colourful words, behaving as, quote, legal monks who pass their lives in an atmosphere of pure law, from which every worldly and human element is excluded, unquote. In many ways, Pound authored the received wisdom of Lochner. Yet, as recent scholarship has shown, the picture he conveyed was somewhat distorted. The reality of what the Lochner-era judges were up to was more complicated than he cared to admit. Strangely enough, those judges were both virulently anti-empirical and empirical at one and the same time. Their anti-empiricism was dictated by an abstract and highly ideological laissez-faire era assumption about the nature of equality in modern industrial relations. Drawing a page out of Herbert Spencer's Social Statics, to paraphrase Holmes's Lochner dissent, the judges assumed, with little attention to real-world conditions, symmetrical bargaining power as between employers and employees, i.e. that employers and employees were equally free to accept or walk away from proposed labour contracts. In this wholly fictitious world of symmetrical power, social welfare legislation represented an impermissible attempt either to rig an otherwise equal game in favour of the worker or to prevent the worker from exercising his personal sovereignty in deciding whether to accept the terms of employment offered.
The only way such legislation might be justified was on narrow health grounds. If the legislature could show that its law was intended only to safeguard the physical health of the workers, rather than to paternalistically interfere with the industrial bargaining relationship itself, the law might pass constitutional muster. Interestingly, it was at this point in their reasoning that the Lochner-era judges suddenly became very interested in the real world, for on the question of health dangers, they were not content merely to accept the say-so of the legislature, i.e. they were not prepared to be bound by the mere forms of legislative assurances, but instead insisted on reviewing the health facts for themselves in an exercise of quasi-de novo review. Looking back at Lochner today, we can put its benighted formalism into clearer perspective than Pound was able to. Properly understood, that formalism, in the form of a priori assumptions about the nature of industrial relations that bore no semblance to reality, operated to keep certain issues off the table. The state of New York could not talk about, because it couldn't hope to win by citing, workers' poverty, or the disempowering effect of worker demographics, or how each of these factors, separately or in combination, prevented workers from bargaining equally with employers. To have talked about either of these things would have been to impugn the formidable laissez-faire paradigm on which the Lochner justices based their world view. Having thus rendered the explosive subject of class-based inequality off-limits and taboo, the formalism then served to channel discussion and fact-finding into a much narrower tributary, that of health dangers, the navigation of which imposed fairly prosaic questions about the weakness of the middle-aged respiratory systems and the requirements of podiatric fitness. These were, of course, downstream phenomena of relatively minor importance, but focusing on them kept the social order intact until, ultimately, the pressures of the Great Depression priced the judges' disassociation from reality out of the market. B. Our modern-day Lochner. The notion of taboo subjects that are off the table, combined with a penchant for empiricism in areas of relatively minor concern, should sound familiar to anyone who has considered the ways establishment scholars, statesmen, and journalists have treated the subject of 9/11. In the 9/11 context, the key taboo claim is that the government is not well-intentioned towards its citizenry. Importantly, this claim is no more entertained by the establishment today than the claim that workers lacked equal bargaining power was entertained by the Lochner-era establishment. It is not entertained because it impugns a formidable paradigm, according to which government officials and agencies in the First World West uniformly and consistently work to advance the welfare of the citizenry at large. A few examples will suffice to show this paradigm at work. Throughout their analysis of how best to combat false conspiracy theories, such as the allegedly 9/11 alternativism, Sunstein and Vermeuler, quote, assume a well-motivated government that aims to eliminate conspiracy theories or draw their poison if and only if social welfare is improved by doing so. They do not defend this assumption as realistic in any real-world sense, justifying its use instead on the thin and uncritical basis that it is, quote, a standard assumption in policy analysis, unquote. Translation: we will base our study on a potentially flawed premise because we do not care to inquire into the nature of a world governed by its opposite. It hardly needs pointing out that to assume a well-intentioned government as the premise for a study on conspiracy theories, which often rest on assumptions of a malintentioned government, is to assume away the most important debate. Then there is well-regarded international relations theorist John J. Mearsheimer, who writes an entire book detailing the lies that Western leaders tell their citizens about foreign affairs, yet is at pains to assure his readers, without any proof or even attempt at explanation, that, quote, leaders usually tell international lies for good strategic reasons, not because they are craven or corrupt, unquote. Legal scholar Michael Glennon argues that an unaccountable, national security-obsessed bureaucracy dictates all significant policy choices to elected officials, who are mere fronts, yet attributes this phenomenon to the benign fact of, quote, smart, hard-working, public-spirited people acting in good faith who are responding to systemic incentives, unquote. Finally, journalist and MSNBC commentator Rachel Maddow authors a study exposing the exponential growth of the U.S. military-industrial complex and the placement of the United States on a permanent war footing, yet insists without reference to any evidence whatsoever that these malign developments have all been, in effect, terrible accidents that nobody intended. A second taboo claim that hovers around discussion of 9/11 is that First World Western societies, such as the United States, are not open and free enough to allow their citizens to easily uncover officials' crimes against them. Sunstein and Vermeule, for example, do not seem prepared to entertain this claim in the slightest, assuming without argument that the United States is an open society where, quote, the press is free, unquote, and, quote, checks and balances are in force, unquote. In open societies such as the U.S., they insist, quote, it is harder for government to keep nefarious conspiracies hidden for long, unquote. Conspiracy theorizing, they sniff, is for closed societies only. In like vein, political scientists Uskinski and Parent approvingly cite Noam Chomsky's dismissal of 9/11 theories implicating the Bush administration. Chomsky asks, quote, did they plan it in any way or know anything about it? This seems to be extremely unlikely. They would have to be insane to try anything like that. If they had, it is almost certain that it would have leaked. It's a very porous system. Secrets are hard to keep, unquote. In reality, none of the a priori assumptions about modern-day America noted above are justified on the known facts. Indeed, by any standard of measure, the reality of modern-day America may well differ strikingly from what these intellectual elites posit. There is good evidence to suggest, for example, that the U.S. government is no longer subject to popular majoritarian control and is, for all intents and purposes, an unaccountable oligarchy. There's good evidence that, far from being subject to the control of its citizens, the U.S. government successfully employs extreme measures that enable it to control them. Finally, there is good evidence that the U.S. government has an immense ability to keep official crimes hidden from public view for very long periods of time. All of these assertions, by the way, are footnoted. We're up to footnote 70 so far. We know that it uses a variety of tools to ensure this secrecy,
ranging from the overclassification and/or destruction of government documents to the control of the press to the prosecution, actual or threatened, of government whistleblowers. Although there may be an argument, somewhere, somehow, that a government possessing these characteristics is likely to be well-motivated and open towards its citizenry, I, for one, have yet to hear it. Now, just to illustrate how detailed some of these footnotes are, footnote number 70 on Operation Northwoods and Gladio says these operations did not come to light for over 40 years, and their cover-ups were by no means exceptional. Following its inception in the early 1950s, Project MK-Ultra, a CIA program to develop techniques of mind control through the use of hallucinogens, sensory deprivation, sexual abuse, and other forms of torture, was kept hidden for 25 years. Tellingly, the secrecy of this project was maintained despite the fact that it involved the participation of personnel from 86 universities and institutions. A smaller yet significant example of a successful cover-up occurred in the case of a U.S. government program of involuntary medical experimentation on foreigners. This program, which involved the injection of syphilis and gonorrhea into the organs of non-consenting Guatemalan citizens, was kept hidden for over 60 years. Footnote 72, on the destruction of documents in the case of MK-Ultra, the then CIA director Richard Helms ordered all records of project activities destroyed in 1973, As Senator Kennedy noted with exasperation, this document destruction was accompanied by a surprisingly thorough bout of official amnesia. Quote, in spite of persistent inquiries by both the Health Subcommittee and the Intelligence Community, no additional records or information were forthcoming, and no one, no single individual, could be found who remembered the details, not the director of the CIA, who ordered the documents destroyed, nor the official responsible for the program, nor any of his associates. Unquote. To return to the main text.
In fact, given the political and social reality of present-day America, I would argue that establishment intellectuals, as well as the statesmen they influence, are very much like Pound's cloistered legal monks. Armed with comforting models, they gaze outward, yet see neither the emaciated workers standing at the factory gate, nor the union-busting goon squads of the employer. Of course, many establishment intellectuals are social scientists, and as such, they are both trained and presumably eager to study the real world. And so, just as the Lochner-era judges investigated health matters, so too do they. The mental health, histories, habits, and motivations of those who question official government narratives, as well as of the terrorists themselves. Why our intellectual elites spend their time swimming in the tributaries of minor concern is an interesting question. Indeed, determining how and why minds are closed to key social facts for any group in any era is a difficult but critical task. For the Lochner-era judges, one can only speculate. The mental blockage was possibly due to parochial class interests rationalized as natural law truths, and mixed with doses of arrogance and ignorance. For our current crop of elites, speculation can give way to a bit more certainty as two explanations present themselves, fear and corruption. Today's establishment elites have several things to fear from questioning the official 9/11 account. First, they might reasonably fear reputational insult, i.e. being labelled irrational, paranoid, unpatriotic, greedy, and or self-promoting. As Professor De Haven Smith has shown, this fear comes courtesy of a CIA propaganda campaign masterminded in the late 1960s to discredit critics of the Warren Commission report. Second, they might reasonably fear being targeted in more tangible ways. Notes Richard Jackson relative to the scholarly silence on the subject of Western state terror, quote, some scholars may be intimidated by state power, fearing the ways in which state officials and state apologists can punish and harm scholars who apply the term terrorism to state actions, unquote. Retaliatory options are not hard to imagine. Research funding might suddenly dry up, accusations of misconduct might suddenly be lodged, private emails might be read. Indeed, in a twist of fate that can only be described as Orwellian, scholars who question too much in the wrong direction might have their online communications anonymously interfered with by government agents working in the cognitive infiltration program proposed by none other than Professors Sunstein and Vermeuler. Then there is the delicate issue of academic corruption. Government funding for higher education may well have fallen off in recent years, but supporting official government narratives and or pursuing lines of inquiry that support the agenda of key establishment players is still where the money is. This is as true for the fields of political science and terrorism studies as it is for the fields of medicine, pharmacology, business and economics. Although it's impossible to quantify the extent to which scholarship in general and 9/11 scholarship in particular is determined by the interests of academic funding sources, it's equally impossible to deny the reality and the corrosive effect of this dependence. Where, then, does all this leave us? With a bit of mental adjustment work to do, I would suggest, in order to nudge the cloistered monks of his day into the real world. Roscoe Pound famously called for a, quote, sociological jurisprudence, a tearing down of the wall separating law from social and political facts. A similar tearing down of walls is needed on the issue of 9/11. Scholarship in the political and social science is admittedly not reducible to journalism. It has both higher and deeper aspirations. Yet, who would deny that if such scholarship becomes too divorced from the facts of the actual human world, it loses most, perhaps all, of its relevance and virtue? Through an appeal to history regarding the reality of past false flag attacks, actual and proposed, mass casualty state terror, and intellectual formalism, I have tried to pry open the mental space needed for scholars to begin to engage the reality of false flag attacks used for the most nefarious of purposes. While I do not expect establishment intellectuals to run out and begin writing books that challenge the official 9/11 account, I do urge them to begin addressing the topic on its merits rather than simply ignoring or ridiculing it. At the very least, I hope that they will open their minds sufficiently to welcome and perhaps even to demand a proper international investigation of the 9/11 case. This final section of the article is devoted to the theory and mechanics of just such an investigation.
And we're going to have to stop there due to time because I've got another full hour interview. So if you'd like to download the original and read her recommendations, then you can do so by downloading the paper from unwelcomeguests.net/736. Now, the official US narrative on 9/11 has been challenged by various politicians, some of them in the West, some of them still serving, some of them retired. Figures such as, for example, former head of the Italian government, Francesco Cossiga, who said this is well known, that Mossad were the agency most involved. And, I mean, if you're in any doubt, what are these pages from the report which Bush's own government produced, which was so sensitive that somebody made the decision that they must be hidden, even from the controlled US political puppets? So I think in terms of evidence, there is no shortage. But if you're hoping for any kind of formal investigation from the powers that be in America, well, I think Amy Baker Benjamin clearly woke me up to just how sewn up, how co-opted the supposed international community is, never mind the domestic community. Now, I'd love to be proved wrong on this. It is in theory possible for the UN delegates to say, we think we've dropped the ball on this one, better late than never, let's instigate formal procedure, get a working group together to investigate the evidence. But on past record, this doesn't seem to be happening. I'm going to be explaining at the end of the show why I think this could be some kind of a sea change of how humanity governs its affairs, a definitive proof, if any more were needed, of the fundamental danger, not to mention the monstrosity, of the formerly prevailing notions of power and social hierarchy, which we've inherited from our forebears. Now let's turn to a leading 9/11 researcher. This is Christopher Berlin, who is being interviewed in March 2016, that's just last month, by Bonnie Faulkner for the highly recommended Guns and Butter Show. And if you'd like to download more such as this, you can do so from kpfa.org/program/guns-and-butter, or probably just type guns and butter into an internet search engine of your choice.
Christopher Bolin is an independent researcher, investigative journalist, and author. Upon graduation from high school in Cook County, Illinois, he spent the next 3 years traveling extensively throughout Europe and the Middle East, finally settling in both a kibbutz in Israel and in Norway, where he studied Egyptian, Biblical Hebrew, and Norwegian at the University of Oslo. He is a graduate of the University of California in history with an emphasis on Israel-Palestine. Along with research and writing, he has worked as an editor and translator. His travels and studies of German, Spanish, Norwegian, Swedish, Hebrew, and Arabic languages have helped him analyze international politics and events. He is the author of Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, and Solving 9/11, The Articles. Christopher Bolin, welcome again.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
In Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, you have a chapter entitled The Architecture of Terror, Mapping the Network Behind 9/11. This chapter includes a dizzying array of connected companies and people, both in and out of government, that were in positions to facilitate and orchestrate the events of September 11th. You met with Andreas von Bülow, the former head of the parliamentary commission that oversaw the financing of the German intelligence agencies. What did von Bülow have to say about what he termed as a, quote, sophisticated false flag operation like 9/11?
Well, the first thing he told me was this was in November or early December 2001 in Germany. He told me that the first of all, he suspected that Israeli intelligence was behind the 9/11 atrocity. And then he said that such a sophisticated operation, a false flag operation, would involve three different levels. The first level, he said, was the architectural level. This is the people who planned the false flag crime in order to have it blamed on a third party. In this case, you know, the Arab Muslims, fanatics of Osama bin Laden. And the purpose of their false flag terrorism is to basically change public opinion. In this case, change U.S. public opinion to support the war agenda in the Middle East and to support the increased defense spending. The second level, he said, was the managerial level. These are the people who managed the setting up of the crime and then managed the deception that follows the crime. And they also, this managerial level, control the third level, which is the working level. And for example, he said the working level is part of the deception. In this case, the working level would be, for example, the 19 Arabs, the alleged hijackers.
Did von Bülow have anything else to say about his opinion of this operation?
Yes, well, it was surprising that he said, quite frankly, that he thought it was an Israeli operation, Israeli intelligence. And I went ahead and reported that in the report that I wrote up about our discussion. And he was surprised because he had said the same thing to German journalists. But as he said, that none of the German journalists would ever publish such a statement. But I did. And he was a little bit surprised at that, you know, our media or the paper I wrote for would go ahead and say such a thing.
You write that there is evidence of an Israeli intelligence network connecting every key player and entity behind 9/11. The people and companies and their interrelationships are quite complex. Can you talk about a few of these networks, the people and companies?
Yeah, well, there's a, like you said, there's a host of them. Ehud Barak, for example, when he lost the election to Ariel Sharon, came over to the United States in the late winter of 2000 and was working in the United States, you know, for the 10 months or so prior to 9/11. And he worked with a company, that was actually produced aluminum nanoparticles, nanocomposites, which is one of the key elements of, nanothermite. And then there was, as you said, in that chapter 7, The Architecture of Terrorism, there's a whole host of companies, you know, including NICE and NICE, that's an Israeli company, and others. And as I found, as I demonstrate in this chapter, these Israeli companies are all interrelated, interlinked with, for example, the the scores of Israeli art students who were spying on and trying to set their stuff up in DEA offices across this country. These companies and these relationships were actually investigated after I wrote the chapter by an English editor and a fact checker. And he examined 105 statements that I made in that chapter and found that all of them were correct. And this was a person in England who was actually hostile to my thesis that this was an Israeli operation. But he was hired by a publisher in Europe to check the facts of that chapter that you referred to, the architecture of terrorism, and found that all of my connections, all of my statements were in fact true.
Yes, that chapter is very complex. It was hard for me to hold it in my mind all at once because there's so many interconnections and a huge cast of characters. Now, you mentioned the art students. This is a very important point. You go into that in some detail in your book. What can you tell us about these art students? Who do we think they might have been?
Well, that's a really interesting. These art students were Israelis who pretended to be art students. And actually, though, I think it was the DEA had done a working paper, an analysis of these students who had been arrested and who had been caught, and found that they were actually Israeli military personnel, active, who had served in or were members of demolition units. Many of them, like there was a Per Segelowitz, I think his name was, who was one of the heads of these teams, and he had led a platoon or a group of like 80 other soldiers, and their specialty was in fact demolition. And these people were the ones who were found trying to infiltrate into DEA offices, drug enforcement agency offices, and private homes of agents of the DEA across the United States. And this when this information came out, this was also part of the Carl Cameron four-part series on Fox News that came out just after 9/11. But there's a tie-in. These individuals in this Israeli art student spying operation were connected to Israeli companies that were, also tied into 9/11. As you said, it's very complex. It's what I've done is I've created a flow chart sort of thing where I have mapped out these entities and show the relationships between them. And what Israeli intelligence has done for a long time, actually, in this country, in the United States, is that they set up a company in Israel. The research and development of the company is done in Israel, and they create the headquarters, their business office for that company in Menlo Park, California, or Silicon Valley, or Boston, or what have you. And so it has the appearances from the outside of being an American company when in fact it is an Israeli intelligence operation 100%.
Now, you just said that these Israeli art students, so-called, at least some of them, were arrested. What were they arrested for?
Well, they were arrested and caught when they were very aggressively trying to get into or they're harassing DEA offices and DEA personnel at their private residences. And so the DEA document lists the names, sometimes the spelling isn't quite correct, of these agents as they were caught, as they were observed, trying to basically infiltrate DEA offices across the country. And this was going on in I think it was in Texas and California and a lot in Florida. Most of the activity was actually being done in Florida, right around the area where these 19 alleged hijackers lived.
Well, now, do you have any opinion as to why they would be trying to infiltrate the DEA? I mean, now, there is evidence that these 19 or how many ever accused hijackers that were living in Florida were actually dealing drugs. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that could very well be. And the thing is that what we also know about the alleged hijackers, the 19 Arab alleged hijackers, is that many of them had been issued duplicate licenses. And when you read the details, you find that, you know, for example, one of the Arab hijackers would get the license on a Wednesday, and the very next day, a call would come into the DMV, what have you, the people who issue licenses in Florida, requesting a duplicate license issued, and with the excuse that the person had moved to a new residence and had a new address. So what you have is you have basically two IDs for the same person in circulation at the same time. And this is an indication that, and many of these people had also reported having lost their passports. So what this indicates is that there were two people going around with the same ID, leaving basically a false trail in the name of the person who was to be implicated in the crime. So that's a Mossad operation tactic that's been used for a long time, and it's very well described in the book by John Le Carré. He wrote a book in 1982 called The Little Drummer Girl. And it's about a similar Israeli terror operation in Europe. George Roy Hill made a film about it. But the book explains how this is done, how a false trail is left to implicate a person in a crime. And that's what we have. That's apparently what we had with these 19 alleged hijackers. Somebody was leaving a trail in their name to implicate them in the crime. And as you say, why would the Israelis be interested in infiltrating and getting into DEA offices? Probably because they were trying to do intelligence gathering on the DEA. And what I see is that the Clintons and the Bush families have been involved in this drug operation that began back in the 1980s, you know, in between the Medellin cartel, and the Israelis were involved in this. So having access to the DEA offices and the information would give them the power, especially with this computer enterprise software, to know what is going on in the DEA at any given time in real time. That's what they probably wanted.
And how would that information have benefited them?
Well, the thing is that, as I point out in the chapter of the planes of 9/11, the second chapter of the book, Solving 9/11, the Israeli Aircraft Industries, IAI, has long had a base in Bogota, Colombia. And I believe, and I think the evidence is pretty clear, that the Israelis have been involved in this drug operation from Colombia to the United States, along with the Bush family and the Clinton family. And nothing ties people more closely together than a crime committed together. And I think that the crime here is this, that they basically took over the Medellin drug cartel operations. And this is, I think, why Philip Marshall was killed in Calaveras County a year or so ago, because he had written a book called Lakefront Airport. And he writes about his experiences. It's an autobiographical novel in which he writes about his experiences being the personal pilot, the Learjet pilot for Barry Seal. And Barry Seal was, of course, the drug smuggler who turned to be a DEA informant. And this is the crime where these families are connected. The operation was being run out of the White House, out of the basement of the White House by Papa Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush. And Bill Clinton was, of course, the governor in Arkansas when Barry Seal was flying all this massive amounts of cocaine into Arkansas. And what the problem is for them is that this pilot, Philip Marshall, knew the names, knew the places, knew the operation, and had written a book about it. And he was planning to write a fourth book. But the third book, Lakefront Airport, is very hard to get. Right now, if you want to buy it on Amazon, it costs about $600. But I just read it, and you can see very clearly that it's his inside knowledge of this drug operation, weapons and drug operation called, you know, the Iran-Contra thing, that's what put his life in danger, because he knew the names and he knew what was going on. The reason I think he was killed was because he had inside information, firsthand information, about the drug smuggling operation that involved the Clintons, the Bushes, and the Israelis. That's why he was a danger to the system.
I'm speaking with investigative journalist and author Christopher Bolin. Today's show, Architects of Terror. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
You mentioned the little drummer girl. You write that John le Carré's 1983 novel, The Little Drummer Girl, is about Israeli false flag operations, and that in the preface to his book, John le Carré thanked past and serving officers of Israeli intelligence. I believe The Little Drummer Girl was also made into a movie. Yes, you mentioned this.
Right.
What is the storyline of The Little Drummer Girl, and what do you think is its significance?
Yeah, John le Carré signed the foreword to that book, or the preface, in I think it was July 1982. And that's exactly the time when the Israelis were invading Lebanon in 1982 under Ariel Sharon and Menachem Begin. But as he says in the very beginning, he thanks and he names these people. He names the former head of Israeli military intelligence for basically, you know, giving him all this information and insight about how Israeli intelligence operations work in Europe. And in this book, and in the movie, I think it's Diane Keaton plays the role. She's an actress from England, and she's basically recruited by the Mossad to help entrap a Palestinian. And she goes down to Turkey or Greece and hooks up with this Palestinian guy, and they have sort of a relationship, a romance. But the whole purpose of the book is to implicate this Palestinian in terrorism that he, you know, that he's not actually involved in. And in the movie, you know, some of the scenes in the movie involve like Israelis blowing up a synagogue, but it's not really they're not really blowing up the synagogue. They're putting charges in the window and blowing the windows out. It's all theatrics. And that's one of the key statements in the book by one of the Mossadniks. He says that terror is theater. Theater's a con trick. Do you know what that means? Con trick? You've been deceived. And that's very important, you know, to understand how the Israeli military intelligence goes about implicating and setting up a crime like this so that the authorities that do the investigation following the crime come away believing and thinking and having in their hands evidence that implicates, you know, Arabs or terrorists or whatever, Palestinians. When in fact, the whole thing has been basically theater. And that's what we're seeing now and much more in the United States. We're seeing these incidents like, you know, San Bernardino and Boston Marathon. We're seeing, terrorist attacks or terrorist incidents where clearly the public can see that we're being deceived. You know, it's really the theater aspect of these crimes, of these terrorist attacks is becoming very evident. So it's like the game is up. You know, these people are still doing these terrorist attacks. They're still doing them on a daily basis in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. But when they do these kinds of crimes in this country, the public has woken up to the fact that we are being deceived. And that's a really good thing.
There was ultimately an unsuccessful attempt to obtain the security contract for the New York Port Authority back in 1987. Mm-hmm. Who obtained the security contract, and how did they lose it?
Well, that's a very interesting aspect of this crime. A couple Mossadniks, these are high-level Mossad agents. Zvi Malkin is one of them, and the other one is Avram Shalom Ben-Dor. These two men were very high-level Mossad agents working under Esther Harel, the first chief of the Mossad. And the first chief of the Shin Bet, basically. This is Israeli domestic intelligence and foreign intelligence. And Israel, he employed terrorism in his operations. And that's one reason why he was forced to resign from the Mossad in 1963, because he was involved in an assassination tactic of killing German scientists called Operation Damocles, which was being run by Yitzhak Shamir. But the thing is that these two men, Zvi Malkin and Avram Shalom Ben-Dor, came to the United States in the 1980s, and these men had been involved in high-level Mossad operations like the kidnapping of, is it Adolf Eichmann down in Argentina, the former Nazi who was kidnapped, taken to Israel, you know, tried and hanged. And they were also involved in the illegal procurement of plutonium in this country and shipping it to Israel for its nuclear arsenal. So they were very high-level Mossad players, and they came to this country in the 80s, and in 1987, they actually obtained the security contract for the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which was the body that owned the World Trade Center. And this is the agency that oversees the ports and the harbors and the airports and the bridges and tunnels of New York City and New Jersey. They obtained the security contract for the World Trade Center and the Port Authority, and this crime of 9/11 probably would have occurred in the late 80s or early 90s had not a person at the Port Authority discovered that Avraham Shalom Ben-Dor was convicted of a murder in Israel and was using a false name. And this is the person who was the president of the security company that got the Port Authority contract. It was called Atwell Security of Tel Aviv. And it was actually a company that was set up by the big Mossad guy, Shaul Eisenberg, basically Mr. Asia for Israel. And when the Port Authority discovered that Avraham Shalom Ben-Dor was using a fake name and was wanted or was convicted of murder in Israel as the former chief of the Shin Bet, they tore up the contract. And as I said, had they not torn up the contract, 9/11 would have probably occurred in the late 80s or early 90s. But it was discovered, the contract was torn up, but that wasn't the end of the operation. What they then did is Avraham Shalom Ben-Dor went to work for Jules Krull. And Jules Krull and Maurice Greenberg, they had a company together called Krull Associates. And Krull Associates got the security contract for the World Trade Center after the bombing in 1993. So you see, using the offices of this American Jules Krull, the Mossad still got into the security contract for the World Trade Center. But it took them until 1993 to do so.
Well, then, what company or companies held the security contract for the World Trade Center on September 11th?
Well, it was Krull Associates. Krull Associates, headed by Jules Krull and his son, and then involving Maurice Greenberg and his son, they had the Krull Associates. They were given the duty to rewrite procedures, security procedures for the World Trade Center, and they did so. This is after the bombing in 1993. And the 1993 bombing in the basement was basically an FBI sting operation. And it was investigated for the city of New York, for the Robert Morgenthau, the DA of New York. It was investigated by a guy named Cherkasky. I think his name is Michael Cherkasky. And he was the head of investigations for New York City and for Robert Morgenthau. And then the following year, Mr. Cherkasky went to work for Krull Associates when they became the organization that was in charge of security for the World Trade Center. And the Port Authority took all of their recommendations and put them into effect. And this group, Krull Associates, then had the security contract for the World Trade Center and oversaw security for the World Trade Center all the way through to the destruction in 2001.
Could you explain the relationship of Krull Associates with Marsh and McLennan? Who are the people involved in these companies?
Well, it's Jules Krull and his business partner, Maurice Greenberg, also known as Hank Greenberg, who was the former CEO of AIG, the company that got the lion's share of the $180 billion bailout in 2008, 2009. These two men have several companies together, and one of them is Marsh McLennan. And Marsh McLennan is the company into whose computer room the first plane struck. The very first plane went right into Marsh McLennan's secure computer center, which was in the North Tower. And Krull Associates and Maurice Greenberg, they have several companies together. Maurice Greenberg has a whole bunch of, operations with Jules Krull. And their sons are also involved, Jules Krull's son and Maurice Greenberg's son. Maurice Greenberg's son, for example, was the CEO of Marsh McLennan when the first plane struck their computer room. And this is very important because both planes actually struck secure computer rooms, and both computer rooms seem to have been prepared with thermite charges and things like that so that the explosion was spectacular and pyrotechnical. But those are the people, those two characters, Greenberg and Krull. They're very important because Krull Associates also involved people like Jerome Hauer. Jerome Hauer had been a Krull Associate. And he was the guy in San Diego who came on and said, you know, basically that this was the 9/11 was done by Osama bin Laden and the towers fell because of the, you know, burning fuel. Another one was Paul Bremer, who was the first head of the Coalition Provisional Authority. I think it was called the CPA in Iraq. He was basically America's proconsul to run the occupation of Iraq for the first 3 or 4 years, during which time, you know, there was no metering of the oil that was being exported from Iraq. All of these characters are at the highest level of the Iraqi invasion, the invasion of Iraq, and 9/11. I mean, even Jerome Hauer, who was a Kroll Associates employee, was the person who put the Office of Emergency Management hard bunker on the 23rd floor of building number 7. You know, the building that fell down at 5:20 in the afternoon. So, I mean, these people are all connected. This small group of players are very deeply connected in the crimes of 9/11 and the atrocity of what happened on 9/11 and then the war in Iraq.
Do you think the high-tech enterprise architecture company P-TECH was compromised? You write that their enterprise software was used to provide real-time access and control of all data and information on government computer networks on September 11th.
Yes. This is also part of Indira Singh's contribution to 9/11 understanding. Yeah, P-TECH was more than compromised. P-TECH was basically an Israeli operation, and it was enterprise software based in Quincy, Massachusetts, and it was what I call like a false front operation in which people were led to believe that it was a Lebanese Muslim who had set up the company. And that this company had been sponsored by some dodgy Saudi guy who has some ties to terrorism. This is all part of the deception. In fact, the person who was playing the key role in the establishment of the company from the beginning in 1994 and getting its software, its enterprise software, onto U.S. military and government computers was a man named Michael Goff, a Jewish guy from Worcester, Massachusetts, who was a lawyer. And Michael Goff, what he did is that I spoke to him and I asked him how he wound up working for P-TECH. And he said that he had left his law practice in Worcester, Mass. He was working for a good company out there, and he left that law firm and went to work through an agency for P-TECH, which was a little startup company in 1994. And I asked him, well, what agency was that? What agency, you know, was responsible for your going? He couldn't remember. So I think he was not telling me the truth here. And what's interesting is that Michael Goff went on to work for the Mossad company Guardium, which is another computer software company, Guardium with an M at the end. And that's a very clearly an Israeli intelligence operation. So he's working on one hand for Israeli intelligence, and on the other hand, he's working for P-TECH, this dodgy little Arab startup company in Quincy, Mass., whose software finds itself onto all the computers in the United States government military. Well, you know, I think I pinned the tail on the donkey when I say that P-TECH was an Israeli intelligence front operation all along. And this is how you do spying in the big, big picture. When you have enterprise software running on U.S. government computers, you know what's going on in the operation, in the computer network, whichever agency you're talking about. You have absolute control, surveillance operability, and control operability throughout the operation in real time. That is intelligence gathering at the highest level.
9/11 whistleblower Indira Singh said that P-TECH was with MITRE Corporation in the basement of the FAA for 2 years prior to 9/11. What do we know about MITRE Corporation?
Well, MITRE Corporation is based out of MIT originally, and it's part of Lincoln Labs, which is a company that does all of the, you know, the engineering, software engineering, and things like that for the U.S. Air Force. MITRE Corporation is a very big defense contractor. It's based outside Boston, and these two companies were involved, as she said, in the basement of the FAA. Checking for and examining the relationship between the FAA and the military in the event of a crisis like 9/11. I've written a great deal about MITRE and P-TECH and the people involved in this. And again, there's this very strong Zionist influence in MITRE. The former CEO and the people that ran it, James Schlesinger was in there. Rodney Schlesinger, I think it might be. But in any case, this whole operation was basically being done to prepare the understanding and to put the super users in charge of how the communication would flow from the FAA to the military when 9/11 occurred. And this is a very important part of the computer aspect of the crime, because as we now know, there was a drill going on that day, and the air traffic controllers were completely befuddled and didn't understand what was real and what was false that day. But also the communications between the FAA and the military were thwarted and delayed so that there was no proper, effective military response to the hijackings. And this is not by accident. This is done by a very intelligent foe who has infiltrated the most important and sensitive computer networks involved in defense of this country. And that's where we have a very serious problem. You know, that the Israeli military intelligence has infiltrated the computer networks of the U.S. government and military so that they have this super user access to these computer networks. And it went on even in later on. The NSA itself took encryption software from an Israeli company, and I called up the NSA and I said, I mean, how is it that the NSA, you're the signal intelligence of the United States of America, and you give your encryption software responsibility over to a foreign country? They had no problem with that, they said. But I mean, that just gives you an idea of how infiltrated our computer networks are. And it's the same thing what we found out later when with this revelations by Snowden, and I think it was Assange, but the Snowden revelations revealed that in San Francisco, the companies that were involved, I think one was called Prism and another was called Narus, these two companies that were involved in the splitting of the rays and sending the data in real time directly to Israel were both Israeli companies. So what we find is that, you know, at the highest level and the computer networks in this country, military and government, they're completely infiltrated and controlled by Israeli intelligence. Even the cybersecurity czar for the Pentagon was a guy named Amit Yoran, and he's an Israeli, and he and his brother ran this network of hackers, friendly hackers, whatnot. But these are the people who wrote the security protocols for the Pentagon, for the security software. He was the cybersecurity czar for the United States of America, and he's an Israeli citizen. This is how bad it is.
What is the Site Intelligence Group? Who runs it, and what do they do? That's SITE.
Oh, that's very important. Site Intelligence Group is a Israeli intelligence website operation based in Bethesda, Maryland. And the front person for this organization is an Israeli intelligence agent named Rita Katz, K-A-T-Z. And she works out of Bethesda, Maryland. And what this group does is it provides the video feed coming from, for example, ISIS. One of their main clients or main subjects is this Islamic State group in Syria and Iraq. So when we see videos coming from this ISIS group, what is coming to us through this Israeli intelligence website called Site Intelligence Group. And so what it basically means is that our understanding of this Islamic threat in Syria and Iraq called ISIS is most of the time primarily coming to us through these Israelis. And that's very important to understand. This is a good example of how U.S. military and U.S. media view the Middle East through Israeli spectacles, because they are the ones who are providing us with the so-called intelligence, the propaganda, the videos, what have you. And so it's very much like the wag the dog, you know, theme of the movie, in which videos are being provided to us from an Israeli website supposedly portraying this latest threat to, you know, peace in the Middle East. And that's very important to understand, because when, for example, the second video or the video of the second American being beheaded came to, you know, CNN and Fox News, it came from Site. And Site admitted on CNN that they had actually released, Site Intelligence Group had released the video before ISIS had released the video. And as Rita Katz said on CNN, well, this is because we had a copy of the video beforehand. Well, how did the Israeli intelligence have a copy of the video beforehand? before ISIS had actually released the video, unless they're inside the camera. This gives you an idea of how close Israeli intelligence is to this ISIS operation.
Let's talk about Hollywood and the movies. You write about several very important films, including The Medusa Touch of 1978, JFK, the cult classic Brazil, as well as the television pilot for The Lone Gunman. Mm-hmm. What makes these films significant, and who produced them?
Yeah, they're very important. Most of them are Israeli-produced films made by Arnon Milchan, or Arnon Milchan. And he's one of the big media moguls in Hollywood. He's an Israeli guy. He's a very high-level Israeli intelligence agent who's been involved in smuggling of equipment and nuclear triggers and things of that nature for Israel's nuclear arsenal. And in doing that, he was their chief agent in an Israeli operation called LAKAM, L-A-K-A-M, which was basically the operation to procure the essential elements needed for Israel's nuclear arsenal. And this was being run by Shimon Peres, of course, the godfather of Israel's nuclear arsenal. Their main agent was Arnon Milchan in Hollywood. So he was busted, for example. His operation was busted in 1985 for having smuggled something like 850 nuclear triggers for nuclear bombs to Israel. But when the operation was discovered, the triggers had already been sent to Israel. The only people who actually were busted or being sought by FBI were the American underlings. Arnon Milchan was not named in the investigation, although he was the one who ran the whole operation. Well, in 1978, before he even got involved in that smuggling operation for the triggers, he had made a movie in 1978 called The Medusa Touch, his first movie. And in this movie, it was an English-French production, a Boeing 747. The climactic scene is a Boeing 747 flying into the Pan Am building, or a high rise. It looks like the Pan Am building. And then later he made, in the year 2000, he, with his partner, Rupert Murdoch, they had a company called New Regency Films or New Regency Television, and they made a movie called The Pilot Episode of The Lone Gunman, in which a passenger aircraft was hijacked remotely and flown into the World Trade Center. And what this is ideation. This is putting the idea out there in the public domain that people are trying to hijack planes and fly them into the World Trade Center. And he was obviously aware of this plot. In 1978, when he made the movie, he was very close to the head of Israeli intelligence and the head of Israeli military, Ezer Weitzman. So it's like his ideas, his themes of his movies didn't just come out of thin air. He's working from an understanding of what the plots are that are in the making.
And what about the cult classic Brazil? He was also the producer of that, wasn't he?
Yes. That was the film that was written by, I think, Terry Gilliam, the American guy involved in the comedy series on TV. It was a big comedy series, and Terry Gilliam wrote the script for this movie. And what's interesting, it came out in like 1985, and in the movie, it's a grim futuristic piece about life in the future, in which terrorism occurs on a daily basis all around these people. And for example, they'll be at a restaurant and a bomb will go off, and then the waiters come out and bring up a screen and set up the screen. And the background of the whole theme, I think Robert De Niro plays the key role. The background is that the society is at war with the terrorists. There's this ongoing war against terrorism, and the terrorists occasionally put bombs off, here and there. And it's like terrorism became a way of life, and the war on terror was the war that these people were involved in. It's uncanny because it's so close to what we now see happening in Iraq and Afghanistan, these two countries that were the first battlefields of the war on terror. And these two countries, now 14 years after the beginning of the war on terror, now have more terrorism and more deaths due to terrorism than any time in their history. It's worse now in the last year in both those countries than it's ever been. So you can see that the war on terrorism has been extremely expensive and extremely counterproductive, because rather than eliminating terrorism, it has increased terrorism like 10 times. And so last year in Afghanistan, there was a record number of people killed due to terrorism, and likewise in Iraq.
Now, this Arnon Milchan was also the producer of the film JFK, isn't that right?
That's right. That's right. And in that film, of course, the viewer comes away thinking that there's this nebulous group in the U.S. CIA that's responsible for the death of the president. And it's a good film. It's made by Oliver Stone, but there is, of course, no discussion or no presentation of any of the Israeli involvement in the murder of John F. Kennedy. For example, you know, we know now, thanks to Leah Rabin, who wrote a memoir after the death of her husband, that her husband, Yitzhak Rabin, was in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. And she said that, you know, it was just a coincidence, she said. But also, as soon as he went back to Israel in December of that year, 1963, he was made chief of staff. So whatever he did in Dallas apparently was rewarded with the highest position in the Israeli military.
Who was the head of Israeli intelligence that predicted in 1980 that Arab terrorists would attack the tallest building in New York City? What can you tell us about this prediction?
Oh, that's very interesting. That's Yisr Harel. That was the founding chief of the Mossad and of the Shin Bet, Israeli domestic and foreign intelligence. And Yisr Harel was the one who, as I said, was removed from his position at Mossad in 1963 because of his operation to kill German scientists who had been working with Egypt. And in that operation, Yitzhak Shamir was the main guy running the operation, the murder operation. But Yisr Harel was interviewed by a guy named Michael Evans. I think his name was Michael Evans. And this is a Jewish guy from Texas who has a Christian evangelist, Christian Zionist outfit called Jerusalem Prayer Team, I think it's called. Well, in any case, this guy, this Michael Evans, has very close connections to the extreme right wing in Israel, the Likud party, Menachem Begin, and the head of the former head of the Mossad. And in 1980, he reported this, you know, later. In 1980, he was having dinner with Yisr Harel, the former head of the Mossad, and he asked him, do you think terrorism will ever come to the United States? And if so, where? And Yisr Harel told him, yes, I think it will, and they will attack your tallest building in New York City. And they'll attack the tallest building because that's a symbol of your power and your fertility and all that kind of stuff. And he said that that's what they'll do. And lo and behold, you know, 21 years later, that came true. And this prediction was made in 1979 and again in 1980. This is when it was reported by Michael Evans. So clearly the plotting, the planning, the Israeli planning for the 9/11 terror attacks went into high gear in the late 1970s. And this is exactly the time, 1977, when the Likud coalition came to power in Israel. And the Likud coalition is very important to understand. This is the coalition of the former heads of the terrorist outfits in Palestine, Israel, from the 1930s and 40s. This is Menachem Begin, Yitzhak Shamir, Ariel Sharon. This is the most radical, ruthless, and extremist elements of the Zionist movement. This is basically the Jabotinsky Zionists. And they involve the Netanyahu family and the Begin family. And the Shamir family. These are really, really extreme people. And that's not appreciated by people in America because Americans basically don't have the understanding or the historical understanding of Zionism and the different elements of Zionism.
Now, these terrorist groups that you're mentioning would have been what? Irgun and also the Stern Group?
Yeah, there was the two of the biggest ones were the Irgun. That was under Menachem Begin and the Stern Gang or Lehi. And that was under Yitzhak Shamir. And the heads of these two groups came together, as I said, in 1973, formed the Likud coalition, and then they came to power in 1977. And they have basically been in power ever since. At certain times, they've had to share power with the other parties, but they have prevailed. They have been the most powerful ruling party in Israeli politics since the late 1970s. And that's very important to understand because these are the people who have always used terrorism as their modus operandi.
You had a quote from Menachem Begin, actually. Somebody asked him about being the biggest terrorist in the Middle East. What did he say?
Yeah, that's interesting. That was in 1974. I think that it was a British journalist named Russell Howe. And he was asked, how does it feel in light of all that's going on in 1974 to be considered the father of terrorism in the Middle East? And Begin kind of chuckled and said, in the Middle East, in all the world. And so he was taking upon himself the mantle of being the father of terrorism in all the world. And, you know, the truth be known, that's not a far cry from the truth. The Israelis are the ones who have made terrorism, you know, what it is today. And they have played a key role in a great deal of it. You know, and what we've seen in Iraq, for example, that some of these terrorists, when you unwrap their turbans and find their identities, that they're not Iraqi or Afghani at all. They're in some cases, you know, Israeli or British intelligence agents. And that's very important to understand, because then we're not dealing with a real threat. We're dealing with an artificial threat. We're dealing with a fake terrorism. And that's what's really important to understand, is to understand that 9/11 and most of the terrorism that goes on in this world today is in fact fake terrorism or contrived terrorism, false flag terrorism, and that the war on terror, which is what 9/11 was meant to start, is equally a fraud. So that we're living in deceived times, and that the war on terror and the terrorism that we see happening around us is all part of basically a big theater operation, a big psyops. And so when we understand that, we can disabuse ourselves of this notion that we're fighting a war against Islam and the whole Arab world, what have you. No, we're being duped. We're being deceived on a day-to-day basis. And the sooner we understand that, the quicker we'll pull ourselves out of this Zionist war agenda that is destructive of this country and much of the world. You know, it's interesting that the war on terrorism was first articulated in the late 1970s, again, the late 1970s, by Netanyahu himself at the Jerusalem conference in 1979 of the Netanyahu Institute. And Netanyahu had been an employee of the Rothschild in the years prior to this conference. And at the conference, George Herbert Walker Bush, you know, spoke in support of this idea. But the Israeli idea was to get the United States into the Middle East on a war footing to fight the terror groups, what they would call these resistance groups, who were opposed to Israeli occupation and hegemony in the region. So that's where we find ourselves now. We are now camped out in the Middle East on a permanent basis, fighting a Zionist war agenda for them. So there is really no American interest whatsoever. We've been completely tricked into a fraudulent war.
Israelis in the Twin Towers were forewarned about the attacks of September 11th. Isn't that right?
Oh, yes, they were. That what happened is that there was a Israeli instant messaging service called Odigo. And this company had their corporate offices two blocks from the World Trade Center. And their research and development, the operations, was being done in Herzliya, Israel. You know, this is the typical of these Israeli companies I was telling you about. And a couple hours before 9/11, before the first plane struck at, 8:45, a couple hours before that, there was a warning message that went out on this Odigo instant messaging system. And if you were an Odigo subscriber, you would get the message through your BlackBerry or your internet or your email, whatever platform you used, you would get this message. And the message said that there would be something disastrous happening at the World Trade Center. And as the vice president of the company later said, the warning was precise to the minute. So this, in conjunction with the fact that something like 4,000 Israelis were expected to have been in the area of the World Trade Center or the Pentagon on 9/11, and that of these 4,000, basically four Israelis perished, indicates to me that most of the people that got the Odigo message stayed away.
In his run for the Republican nomination, Donald Trump has cited an instance of Arab nationals, or maybe he said Muslims, seen celebrating in New York City as the World Trade Center towers exploded. Who, in fact, were these celebrants?
Yeah, this is a very odd thing, because he's blaming Arabs for something that turned out to be Israelis. There were indeed five Middle Eastern men who had been seen celebrating the attack on the World Trade Center and clicking their lighters and giving high fives on the Jersey side of the river there. But this was reported by Ted Koppel at about noon on 9/11, and he said they were Middle Eastern men. But these five Middle Eastern men turned out to be Israeli agents. So they were the Kurtzberg brothers and then three other operatives. And these men were arrested by New Jersey police in the afternoon on 9/11. And they were found to have been carrying box cutters, thousands of dollars stuck in their socks and things like that. And their van tested positive for explosives. It was then turned over to the FBI, and these men were held in detention in Brooklyn for about 2 months. And then they went back to Israel, and they appeared on the Yair Lapid show. And in that show, the three operatives admitted that they had been on a mission, and the purpose of their mission was to document the event. And all five of these characters were connected with a company called Urban Moving Systems in Weehawken, New Jersey, which we now know was an Israeli Mossad front company to look like a moving company, but it was basically there to set up the 9/11 operation.
In your powerful two-hour presentation at the Presidio Library in San Francisco, you had a slide of the September 11th memorial at Ground Zero in New York City. There was a design contest for this memorial. Whose design won?
Yeah, it's very interesting that the memorial with the pools and the falling water was designed by an Israeli man named Michael Arad. And Michael Arad is the son of Moshe Arad. And Moshe Arad was the former Israeli ambassador to the United States. And the Arad family is very close to the Netanyahus. So what's interesting is that the legacy, both the museum and the memorial, were designed by an Israeli designer who is connected to basically the godfather of the war on terror, Netanyahu. It's Michael Arad. A-R-A-D.
One thing I didn't realize until you pointed it out is that Larry Silverstein and Benjamin Netanyahu have a very close friendship. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Benjamin Netanyahu and Larry Silverstein had a weekly conversation on the telephone every Sunday afternoon for years prior to 9/11. So that means that Netanyahu, who is basically the godfather of the war on terror, spoke every Sunday afternoon with Larry Silverstein, who was basically the godfather of the 9/11 destruction. I mean, all three towers that fell that day belonged to Larry Silverstein. And these two men, wherever they were in the world, every Sunday afternoon, they would have a discussion on the telephone. And this was reported by an Israeli reporter. And this was published in November 2001 in the Israeli media. And that's very interesting because what were they talking about? You know, these men were having this weekly conversation. And obviously, you know, these two men are the key players in the war on terror and 9/11. And it's interesting to note that Larry Silverstein basically was the recipient of the World Trade Center in late July, July 24th, I think it was, 2001, in which these publicly owned buildings became his private property, at least to the extent that he was able to insure them against an act of terrorism. So when these publicly owned buildings became private property and he insured them, he then became the recipient of something like $7.5 billion when they were destroyed.
Christopher Bolin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bonnie. It's been a pleasure being with you.
Now, many thanks to Bonnie Faulkner for the excellent Guns and Butter. And of course, thanks to Chris Berlin for doing the research and giving the interview. I've been doing some research my own. A couple of days ago, I was looking at appointments controlled by the Bilderberg Group. Now, another leaked agenda of the Bilderbergs found its way onto WikiSpooks. In 1966, the top of the Bilderberg agenda, written by Robert R. Bowie, was the reorganization of NATO. Now, it's interesting to note that since that meeting, no one has ever become NATO Secretary General without attending at least one Bilderberg meeting. And something I put in a couple of days ago, of the three presidents of the European Central Bank, the first two were members of the Bilderberg Steering Committee, and the current one, Mario Draghi, attended the Bilderberg just before he was appointed president of the ECB. And the predecessor organization, the European Monetary Institute, similarly led exclusively by Bilderberg attendees. Now, I do find it interesting there's all this information about what's really happening entering into the public domain, directly contradicting the official narrative about what's supposed to be going on. Now, unless it's just me in a privileged enclave of the internet, I do get the feeling that humanity, yes, unless it's due to wipe itself out, really needs a fundamental shift in the way it's organized. Perhaps, as I suggested last time, a shift towards a more love-centered rather than fear-centered, a gift economy rather than, as we currently have, more or less a slave economy. What would life be like if people were working, not as slaves, but because they felt they wanted to and they had something to give? I feel very privileged to be able to spend my time to have enough days in the week to do research for this show and for WikiSpooks, and thanks to everybody who contributed material, suggestions, and otherwise encouragement. Now, the latest email in my inbox from Jonathan in Sheffield is asking about altruists.org. The site has fallen sadly into disrepair, but I would really like to get that going again. I know from my own experience how much easier it is to help if somebody actually specifically asks, well, if you've got time and you're interested to work on post-money society, how we could organize if we don't have contracts and rules involving this artificial, abstracted mathematical notion, which turns out anyway is controlled by a bunch of psychopaths, then do get in touch. You can contact me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. This and all previous episodes are gifts available from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Now, if you'd like to download multiple episodes, you can do so, 100 at a time, from unwelcomeguests.net/download. I would suggest you might want to grab a backup in case the site goes offline for any reason. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. To help these poor workers, the rich will cut down like an unwelcome guest. You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. Edward Snowden and Glenn Greenwald on Privacy and Surveillance. Excerpt from the March 25, 2016 event at the University of Arizona. Tickets for the cavernous Centennial Hall had sold out days ahead of the conversation on privacy, but the two-hour video was streamed live and is available online. Edward Snowden, Glenn Greenwald, and Noam Chomsky explore the urgent topic of privacy in today's surveillance state. NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden was participating by video stream from Russia. The excerpts you're about to hear focus on him and Greenwald. Glenn Greenwald, of course, is best known as having met with Snowden on his way into exile in Hong Kong in 2013. Greenwald received the documents that Snowden had taken in order to prove the extraordinary depth of government spying that he had observed while employed by the CIA and as contractor for the NSA. Greenwald then was a columnist for the British Guardian and is now founding editor of The Intercept and a frequent guest on CNN, MSNBC, and Democracy Now. Here's a thought-provoking and thoughtful exchange on the resurgence of a free speech movement, constitutional rights in the age of surveillance, the right and even responsibility to alert the public about wrongdoing, the expansion of powers and privileges the government is claiming, and the point of view that rights to privacy exist to protect the minority against the majority. The moderator was Nuala O'Connor, President and CEO of the Center for Democracy and Technology. She asked Greenwald to define his work as journalist.
You are an important actor in this narrative. You've been described as an activist, a journalist, maybe a hack. How do you describe yourself?
You know, ultimately, I don't really see journalism as being this kind of cloistered profession of people who are called journalists and who exclusively possess the right to engage in to exercise the right of a free press. I look at my duties first and foremost as a citizen, just like every other citizen. And among the tools available to me, guaranteed by the Constitution, is a free press. And originally, that was intended to be used by every citizen as a means not to gain employment or to earn a livelihood, but to answer the critical question that was supposed to face the United States at its founding, which is, if we create this centralized government and vest it with all of these extreme powers, how do we prevent it from replicating this tyrannical force that the colonists had just liberated themselves from as a result of this really risky war? And the answer was supposed to be, there were going to be all these mechanisms that were designed to check the wielding of the factions that possessed the greatest power. And one of the most critical checks was supposed to be a free press, the ability to stand up to people who wield power and to say, you're making these claims, and rather than mindlessly ingest them or repeat them, I'm actually going to challenge them and I'm going to investigate them. Rather than letting you operate in the dark, I'm going to shine a light on what it is that you're doing so that the citizenry is aware of the things that you're doing with the power that we have given to you. And so whether you call that activism or whether you call that journalism or whether you call it treason or whatever else you might want to describe it as, you know, to me, much more important than the label is the substance of that function. And to me, the core of that function, at least as I try and embrace it and try and practice it, is to make certain that the people who wield the greatest political and economic power are incapable of doing that with no restraints, but instead constantly meet all sorts of critical scrutiny and impediments and attempts to push back against it. And I think everything that we've done in this matter and in everything else I try and do in my journalism is about trying to make things a lot more difficult for those who wield the greatest power.
Edward Snowden. Ed, you've been called by some a traitor and some a patriot. How do you see yourself, and what is your role in today's debate? And why were you the one chosen to play it?
I said before that whistleblowers are sort of elected by circumstance. The idea here is that we are a government that derives its legitimacy from the consent of the governed. But that consent is only meaningful if it's informed. Now, we're supposed to have a system of checks and balances to ensure that that is always the case. We know what's going on. We have the ability to cast our votes to direct the activities of our government. We have an executive that should be checked by the courts that should be directed by the Congress. And this sort of virtuous cycle is supposed to be founded on the idea of competition between them. However, things have changed increasingly over the existence of our nation from when we were first founded, and we were very allergic to the idea of a strong central power, to the very recent past, where we have a government that seems to be almost completely unrestrained by law or the Constitution. And we've had former government officials say things like, we do what's illegal immediately, the unconstitutional takes a little bit longer. But the idea here is that a nation is comprised of people, as is a community, as is a government, as is every structure in which we cooperate with one another. And we all have not just a right, but a responsibility to alert those around us, the other members of our society, of wrongdoing when and where we see it. Now, there were no whistleblower protection laws that applied to intelligence agency contractors like myself in my position. And as I gained seniority, as I gained awareness of what the government was doing, as I gained sort of higher and higher clearances and access to more classified information, I saw that the public declarations of government officials were very different from the actual reality of what was happening. In fact, we were operating beyond the law in a way that many argued was unconstitutional. And courts have since confirmed that, declaring these programs likely unconstitutional and even calling them Orwellian in their scope. And it's important to understand, how did we get here? How did we reach a point where the individual is all that society can rely upon? Because, of course, we don't want the individual citizen, the individual conscience, to be the last safeguard. Now, giving false testimony to Congress is a felony in our country. And just a few months before the NSA activities showing that they had indiscriminately intercepted the communications of every American, as well as everyone else around the world, when we were seeing videotaped sworn testimony by federal officials, it looked a lot like this.
Does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans?
No, sir. Not wittingly. There are cases where they could inadvertently, perhaps, collect, but not wittingly.
This clip from Edward Snowden shows Senator Ron Wyden questioning James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence.
Now, in his defense, after that became quite publicly known to be false, he first said he was being too cute by half. And then when he realized that was a felony, he quickly amended that to saying he forgot about the program that was monitoring everyone in the country. Now, reasonable people can disagree about where we should draw the lines of surveillance policy. No one argues that we should shut down every surveillance program in the country. No one says we should list the names of everyone who's under surveillance on the newspaper. But if we are to have a democracy, if we are to be partner to government rather than subject to it, we must know at least the broad powers and privileges that the government is claiming. We must know both what they are doing in our name and what they're doing against us, or else we're no longer directed by the public. We're ruled from above.
Glenn, it's a penumbral right. So how are we doing?
You know, no, I do think actually, you know, when you talk about privacy, the starting point is the fact that it is actually protected in the U.S. Constitution, albeit not with the word privacy. If you look at probably the amendment to the Bill of Rights, which received the greatest attention, it was the idea that the government had no power of general warrants, meaning what the king used to do is order entire villages or neighborhoods or cities subjected to house-by-house searches, that instead you had to have this particular suspicion, reasonable cause, in fact, probable cause, that the person was engaged in some sort of wrongdoing before the state had the right to inspect their papers or persons. That is, in essence, the crux of the definition of privacy. And in so many ways, the debates we're having now were settled over 200 years ago when the government said, we don't have mass surveillance in this country. It's a violation of fundamental rights. The only kind of surveillance that is permitted is when the burden that's on the government is met by them going into a court and saying this particular individual has engaged likely, in all likelihood, in some sort of wrongdoing, and therefore we can invade their home, read their papers, and the like. But I want to just take a step back, because I think the question of what is privacy is a really critical question to ask. And the reason is because a lot of times people treat it as though it's this kind of abstraction. Like, we understand why physical needs, like the need for food or shelter or healthcare, are things that are these immediate, urgent needs that are fundamental to who we are. But a lot of people are really willing to be dismissive about the right to privacy, to treat it as this kind of distant, remote value that even for those of us who sort of think it's a good thing, we're not really willing to say that it's something we demand be protected. And I'm sure all of you in this room have heard the rationale that's used by people who want to belittle the right to privacy, and I bet you a lot of you even think it yourselves, which is the idea that, well, you know what? I'm not one of the bad people. I'm not planning any terrorist attacks. I'm not engaged in violent crimes, and therefore I don't actually have anything to hide. And what's really fascinating about that I found over the last few years is that even the people who say that, the people who say they don't actually value their privacy, they don't actually mean it at all. And the proof of it is they do all sorts of things to safeguard their own privacy. I mean, we all have things to hide. There are things that everyone in this room would be willing to have their spouse or their best friend or their physician or their lawyer or their psychiatrist know, but would be mortified to have anybody else know. And the people who say they don't value privacy, they do things like they put and use locks on their bedroom and bathroom door. They put passwords on their email and their social media account. They do all sorts of things to ensure there's a place they can go in the world to think and reason and explore without the judgmental eyes of other people being cast upon them. This is really critical to human freedom. We really understand instinctively, without this abstract debate, why privacy is so critical. We are social animals. We have a need for other people to know and see what we're doing, which is why we post things about ourselves online. But we also have the need to be able to do things without other people watching, because when other people are watching what you're doing, you're much more likely to engage in decision-making that's the byproduct of societal orthodoxies or external expectations and not a byproduct of your own agency and independence. And so when we lose privacy, when we allow ourselves to live in a society where we're susceptible to being monitored at all times, we lose a really critical part of what it means to be a free and fulfilled individual. And as Professor Chomsky was saying, we should not allow that to happen in any circumstance except when the government demonstrates there's a really compelling need.
Ed Snowden, you have perhaps arguably given up some of your own privacy in order that many of us have more, one would hope, in the future. What are your thoughts on that?
There are a couple things that I want to pursue on that. Drawing on the arguments made by a former Supreme Court Justice, Brandeis, who offered that privacy is really something different and altogether more valuable than what we expect in the common usage. When we talk about privacy today in the modern context, we're really asking the word to do too much work. Privacy means many different things to many different people. Privacy for many people is just settings on their Facebook page. And so they go, I don't really care. It's just Facebook. But privacy is so much more. Brandeis said privacy is the right to enjoy the products of our own intellect. I would go further. I would say privacy is the fountainhead of all other rights. Privacy is the right to the self. Privacy is the right, as we have in the Constitution, to freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of religion, freedom from unreasonable search and seizure without probable cause. Privacy is the right to a free mind. Now, how can I say that, right? That seems sort of abstract, but when you think about it, privacy is what allows us to determine what we believe without being influenced by others, without being subject to peer pressure, without our ideas being prejudged before they're fully formed. Freedom of speech has no meaning if you don't have the space, the time, the freedom to determine what it is that you want to say. Freedom of religion has no value if you cannot independently determine what it is that you believe in. Otherwise, you're being influenced by what's popular or what you inherited. Now, when we go further from this, we realize that this is actually inherently understood by generations of speakers, generations of thinkers, going down all the way, which are the underpinnings of our language. It's called private property for a reason. Without privacy, you can't have anything for yourself. You exist as a collective. You exist in a state of reaction to your environment at all times. You are a part of a larger being. But at no time are you permitted to have a space that that is only just for you. And when I sort of follow this, and I think about this in my own terms, particularly when we're confronted with the arguments of sort of apologists for the national security state, and the argument that was first proposed by the Nazis against privacy, which was if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. I would say that arguing that you don't care about privacy because you have nothing to hide is like saying that you don't care about free speech because you have nothing to say. Rights exist and have value for more than just the individual in the current moment. Rights are both individual and collective. And when we think about the value of a free press, we're not all journalists, but we still derive value from them. Moreover, rights are not really intended. Rights are not really designed for use by the elites, the people who are leading our debates, because these are the people who are least threatened with the abrogation of their rights. The system exists to serve and protect these people. Rights are almost always needed on a regular, continuing basis by those who are vulnerable, by those who are not protected by the system, by those who are not protected by their communities, by the people who are different, by the people who are ahead of everyone else, who are proposing a new idea, or people who are simply minorities, don't have access to the same resources, don't have access to the same ability to compete. And to say fundamentally that you don't care about a right, even if it is truly of no value to you, because you're not using it in this current moment and you don't expect to use it in the future, is probably the most antisocial thing I can imagine.
Question from our Two Shoes app. You all clearly care about privacy, and these gentlemen are contributing incredible amounts to this debate and the thought leadership. But do people in general care? Do people's activities online and being willing to give so much information freely show that people are less concerned about their digital selves than perhaps we all might want them to be? Let's start with Ed again.
So I'll try to take this quickly because since I just rambled for some time here, I would argue it depends on the individual because ultimately privacy, your feelings, your beliefs are always individual in nature. You can try to extrapolate from this. You can try to do some polling based on the groups. But to say that it doesn't have value even to the majority isn't really that material, even if it is the case. Again, rights don't exist for the majority. Rights exist to protect the minority against the majority. But even in this context, right, even if we put that aside, I would argue that many people do care about privacy, and they're beginning to care about it more than they have before because they didn't realize it was threatened. They didn't realize they were being watched. As you said previously, we've seen polling that indicates people are getting more protective of their privacy now. They're being more careful. They're concerned about the monitoring that's occurring. And when we think about why this is, generally there's a question here. That I would actually be really interested in the ideas of the other speakers on the stage, is that there's this traditional idea that we inherited that some human interactions leave no trace. They occur without records. They are ephemeral in nature. It's an experience shared between you and your spouse, you and your pastor, or as they used to say, sort of in the privacy of your own home, the things that happen within those four walls are between you and your God, if you believe in them. Now, the NSA and other intelligence services around the world thought, well, that's really quite a shame, because imagine if we could hear everything. Imagine if we could hear what was happening within the four walls of your home. There would be tremendous investigative value in this. Now, they're not wrong. And the problem here is not necessarily that surveillance can occur at all. It's that it happens indiscriminately. It's that it happens to all of us, all of the time. And we're populating sort of buckets with the activities, the records of everyone, because they're out there. They're free. As long as you can access the telecommunications service providers, you can pull them right off the wire, what the government calls metadata, who you call, where you go, the things you've done, the purchases you've engaged with, the diary of activities of your life, with every entry of what you've done, but not necessarily the details of how that you did it. Now, we take that back to this idea that there were private spaces before that no one could intrude upon by virtue of the fact that no records were left behind. If you wanted to know what someone did within their home, you had to ask them, and you had to hope they were willing to cooperate. But what we've seen is the advances of technology have allowed these state security agencies to go, well, why don't we build God from a machine? Why don't we create that form of omniscience through technology and create records on everyone just in case at some point we want to go back and look and see what they did? Now, this is a fairly extraordinary and unprecedented thing. Now, it is possible that the majority of the population would argue that this is a good thing, that we want our governments to be powerful, to be capable, to be omniscient, because then they could thwart additional crimes. But if that is to occur, at the very least, this is a decision that I believe the public should be involved in. We have a right to know, and we have a right to discuss it. This is not a decision that can ever be made for us by a few officials behind closed doors. And unfortunately, that is increasingly what we see happening.
No, I could just address that. You know, on the question of whether people care about privacy, I remember really vividly when Ed and I were in Hong Kong before we started reporting these stories, we spent a lot of time talking about what the likely outcome of the reporting would be. And we really had no idea what it would be. And I remember, because it struck me so much, Ed at one point saying, you know, I don't have any fears about what's about to happen in terms of what gets done to me, about going to prison. And it was clear that he meant that. And he said, the only fear that I really have is that we do this reporting and we unveil this to the world and people just sort of shrug and say, well, I assume the government was doing that, or I don't really care that they were doing that. And that it would be a 1 or 2 day story and then people would forget about it and go about their lives. And of course, that's exactly what did not happen. It became this enormous, incredibly consuming worldwide story, not just in the United States, but in dozens of countries on multiple continents around the world, precisely because people were so angry and offended at the intrusion into their privacy, including people who might have said in the past, I don't really care. And there's all kinds of evidence that shows just how concerned they are, from the massive increase in the number of people around the world who are now using encryption to protect the privacy of their communications, to the number of people who put pressure on the U.S. government and both parties to enact legislation limiting these programs. But maybe the best evidence of all about how much people care about privacy is the behavioral change in Silicon Valley companies, the biggest ones, Yahoo and Facebook and Apple and Google and Microsoft. When I first read the archive that Ed gave me, one of the things that struck me the most was what full-scale collaborators these companies were in the surveillance state that the NSA had created. They were not only complying, there's a helpful chart from Ed that has just magically popped up, all the companies that were part of the prison program and when they joined. And it includes essentially every leading company in Silicon Valley. And they not only cooperated to the extent the law required, but even way beyond that. There were documents about how Microsoft would meet with the NSA to help them build back doors into Skype at the same time that they were promising the public that Skype was impenetrable. And the reason they were such full-scale collaborators is because they were doing it completely in the dark and no one knew they were doing it, and therefore there was no cost. Once we were able to shine a light on what these companies were doing and the full-scale partnership they had created with the government, all of that changed completely. And it didn't change because these companies decided suddenly that they care about your privacy. They still don't care about your privacy. But what changed is their fear that they would lose the current generation or the next generation of internet users to social media companies in Korea or Brazil or Germany who would be able to say, don't give your data to Facebook and Apple because they'll give it to the NSA. Give it to us instead. And they knew that it was really imperative that they demonstrate to the public that they actually are willing to safeguard people's privacy, even if it means standing up to the FBI, refusing, even in a case like San Bernardino, to build a backdoor into iPhones, even if it meant enduring being called aiders and abettors of ISIS or having blood on their hands as a result of helping terrorists hide their communication. All the things these companies have endured and are enduring, not because they're suddenly privacy activists,
but because they know that tens of millions of people around the world care deeply about their privacy and won't use these companies if they think their privacy is going to be compromised. That is the best evidence of all to answer the question, do people care about their privacy?
That was journalist and author Glenn Greenwald, who was the first to see the trove of documents revealing U.S. government surveillance that former NSA contractor Edward Snowden took with him on his journey into exile. This was an excerpt of a meeting on privacy held on March 25, 2016 at the University of Arizona. Snowden participated by video link from Russia. The full two-hour film of the event called Conversation on Privacy, that also includes MIT Professor Emeritus Noam Chomsky, is on YouTube and the websites of The Intercept, Common Dreams, Truthdig, and many more. Links can be found on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced at 94.9 CHRW in London, Ontario, on the traditional territory of the Attawandaron, Anishinaabe, and Haudenosaunee people. We are your hosts, Sarah May Chitty
and Isiana Bastari. In this episode...
Well, hi there, my name is Dana. I play in several bands in London town. The show I play tonight is with
and
Twin
I think
Fin.
That having that male presence lifted from the SPHR side also emboldened more to come. And I'd say that it got up to about 17 men that were surrounding Rhonda in the atrium.
And we work specifically on cognition, so on learning, memory, attention, and phenomena like that.
But first, here are your headlines. The Black Lives Matter Toronto Coalition has set up a tent city outside the Toronto City Police headquarters. They have been camping out in resistance since Sunday, when the police announced last Friday that they would not be pressing charges against the police officer who shot and killed unarmed Andrew Loku last summer. Black Lives Matter organized a rally at Nathan Phillips Square on Sunday, culminating in the tent city. The tent city is now running into the end of its first week with no intention of letting up until demands are met. Yusra is a leading organizer with Black Lives Matter.
Okay, so we came together on Sunday evening because we received so many negative news coming to the Black community in the past week. We found out that the killer of Andrew Loku was not charged, and this was an injustice because they released this announcement on Friday evening because they thought that no one was going to care and it was going to flood into the weekend and nobody was going to pay attention. But we have been devastated. We also heard within that week that Afrofest, which is a massive festival that Black Torontonians come into a space to be able to heal and share our culture, our music is being cut from a two-day festival to a one-day festival. We think that this is an absolute injustice because it's a violation of our community. There is no consultation to us as a community about any part of this decision-making, and this is a problem. So we decided to come together on Sunday evening at Nathan Phillips Square to host a mini Afrofest. We had artists in the space, music in the space, children and elders. We decided to hold the space also to honor Andrew Loku's death, but also to fight against police brutality and how many Black people have died at the hands of police.
Black Lives Matter protesters have been receiving lots of support from people around the city and solidarity from Indigenous land defenders.
We've been having absolutely tremendous unwavering support from the indigenous community. They've been riding with us from the jump. So we've been here for like 3 days since the beginning. They've been trying to help us heal. They've been protecting us. They've been blessing the land and supporting us through all the violence that we experienced.
According to the Black Lives Matter Facebook group, Toronto police shut off the power outside their headquarters on Thursday morning, leaving protesters in the dark, just as the city was feeling the effects of a late March ice and snowstorm.
Some of our demands that we're putting forward is for the name of the police officer who killed Andrew Locu to be released and made public, for the footage in which Andrew Locu was killed in his apartment complex to be made public information. In the United States, people have access to these modes of accountability. Here in Canada, we don't have access to this mode of accountability. So we're fighting for that. We're fighting for an overhaul in the SIQ. We're fighting for accountability for Andrew Locu's death. And we're fighting for us to be able to exist without being attacked and to be able to be free.
Organizers are calling for an all-out day of action at police headquarters for Saturday. Groundwire will keep you posted.
It's been almost a month since the president of Western University's Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights student organization was surrounded by 15 to 20 men and verbally attacked on campus, and the silence surrounding the attack is getting uncomfortable for some students. SPHR President Rhonda Albayumi and fellow member Marie Rue were participating in the club's annual Israeli Apartheid Week in the university's community center on February 29th.
All of the clubs have their atrium day, and it was SPHR's atrium day. The focus of the event was about the West Bank and the separation and lack of freedom of movement that exists for Palestinians in the West Bank.
During this event, the women were approached by supporters of Israeli protesting their presence in the atrium. According to Marie, discussion began between members of SPHR and their protesters, and the protesters started to get heated. Approximately 12 protesters surrounding the SPHR president and another executive continued to argue with them about the event.
They were surrounded at this point. The other executive was a man, and he had distanced himself too. And I think that having that male presence lifted from the SPHR side also emboldened more to come. And I'd say that it got up to about 17 men that were surrounding Rhonda in the atrium, shouting from all sides. Some of them called her a terrorist and things like this. At that point, we contacted the USC and decided that campus police should be called in to break down.
A USC administrator tried to break up the group, but was challenged by the protesters that she was stifling her free speech. It was not until campus police arrived that the situation was diffused.
I think it's also important to notice that this is not something that has come out of nowhere. SPHR executives, primarily women and primarily visible Muslims, have faced abuse on campus for years now. I know I've personally, in my time organizing, been both spit on and stalked, and I'm the white girl in the club. The other girls have faced issues where people go to their professors and try to turn them against them. They've faced physical intimidation. They've faced straight-out racism and blatant racism on the campus. And none of those have really been fundamentally addressed by the university. Sometimes it's sort of a reactionary response to something in particular that happens, but there's been very little institutional shift in the way that we look at things.
In the days following the incident, no formal communication between the University Student Council and SPHR evolved. Marie says the silence is unwarranted when the safety of a student was threatened while engaging other students in political discussion. She then wrote USC President Sophie Helpert a letter asking her to acknowledge what happened and clarify this kind of behavior is not tolerated. It was not until the letter went viral and was published in the Western Gazette that Sophie reached out to SPHR to set up an appointment for the next week.
We're sort of at this point establishing what we feel would be an appropriate response, which at this point we're feeling would be official formal condemnation from the USC, a minor apology maybe from Israel on campus, and we feel that there should be sensitivity training, particularly to how you shape your message on campus for executives in the following years.
It is not known whether the aggressors were part of another club, Israeli on campus, and Marie says SPHR is not holding them accountable for the particular incident. A police investigation was launched but quickly closed because campus police were unable to identify Rhonda's harassers. Despite the best efforts, Marie says this violence has not dampened the group's passion and they will continue to be active on campus.
Gated communities in flux.
You just heard Genocide by Whoopso. They just released that track on Pentagon Black's paper compilation of Canadian DIY bands. Now it's time for our feature stories.
Western University cognitive behavioral neuroscience researchers are breaking grounds in finding more about Alzheimer's disease. Jocelyn Wong investigates the new discoveries and research methods Western neuroscientists are using to learn more about cognitive diseases. Take a look.
What actually happens to the brain of patients with neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's? Lisa Saxida and Tim Bussey from Western Research Chair in Cognitive Neuroscience tell us more about mice, milkshakes, and touchscreen tablets. So what brought you to London all the way from the UK?
Well, you know, it's funny. We weren't thinking about moving. So we were based in Cambridge, which is a wonderful place to be. It's a wonderful place to work and live in. But we came to visit Western last year, and we're just completely blown away by the attitude here. So everyone that we met was just really interested in science and fantastic and wanted to set up collaborations and the resources and community. The neuroscience, cognitive neuroscience community here at Western is just really very exciting. I guess what Western has done over the last few years is put a massive investment into cognitive neuroscience as a particular area of focus for the university.
I heard a part of the reason was also because the Robarts Research Institute. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, that's one of the things that Western is really known for, is the imaging facilities and the imaging experts that they have here. We're also in the Brain and Mind Institute, and so there are a lot of people doing imaging there that we're looking forward to collaborating with.
You two are involved in a research in London right now, are you?
And we work specifically on cognition, so on learning, memory, attention, and phenomena like that, and how those processes are based in the brain, and how they work in the healthy brain, and also how they work in brains that are damaged by disease or injury. And one of the things that we're interested in doing with our research is improving translation from basic science into the clinic. So one of the things that we've developed is a method for testing models of Alzheimer's disease and other diseases, mouse models in particular, on the same types of cognitive tests that you would test a human patient on. One of our tasks is a task where you have to remember an object in a particular location. Correct. So our mice interact with a touchscreen type system, which is like an iPad, and they're rewarded with strawberry milkshake when they get answers correct. And this is very similar to the way that you would test a human, as opposed to putting them in a maze or something like that. And so it's actually quite difficult to do because you have to map multiple objects onto multiple different locations. And it turns out that mice are pretty good at doing this task. And this task is really interesting because it's a task that seems to be very sensitive to picking up on Alzheimer's disease very early on, before people are showing any of the more significant memory impairments that would take them to the clinic. But we are also building collaborations with people here in London at the moment. So Marco and Vania Prado, for example, we're working with them, and we may actually start some behavioral experiments using their lab space in the near future.
How are the mice similar to humans in the way they think, I guess, is my next question.
It's a good question. Do you want to?
Well, it is important that these models have what we call neurocognitive validity, meaning exactly what you're saying, so that when a mouse solves a particular test in the laboratory, that they're solving that test in the same way that the human solves the test, meaning the same brain circuits, the same psychological processes.
What advantages does working at Western give you in your research?
We need people working at the molecular level, at the circuit level. I think mouse models are part of that, an important part of it. Again, imaging is incredibly useful for understanding Alzheimer's disease. So as with anything in cognitive and behavioral neuroscience, it's really a converging approaches. All of these different methods, different species and different levels of analysis have to come together to solve a problem as difficult as something like Alzheimer's disease. A lot of that is now involving some very modern and exciting methods that we can use to probe the brain. Some of those methods, you may have heard these, that you can drive neurons with light or put designer receptors into into the brain, you know, and then these are things that we haven't done that much of in Cambridge. And it's those kinds of new and exciting methods that we're really looking forward to taking forward here. We think it's going to take our research to the next level, really. A part of the reason that we think we can do that probably better here is because of the resources and because of the collaborators that we've encountered here, people who have expertise in these areas. So we can kind of marry our behavior with their molecular and circuit level approaches to do those kinds of experiments.
That's right, because each of these different techniques and each of these different levels of analysis allow us to ask slightly different questions. Mm-hmm. And it's bringing all of those different, the answers to all of these different sort of smaller questions together that's going to help us really develop an understanding of these diseases.
What are generally the biggest differences or similarities that you found in your research lab or peers as compared to your colleagues at Cambridge?
One thing about Leicester that's quite different from Cambridge is this level of institutional support for cognitive neuroscience. So I think that is actually really unique to see a university put so much kind of, emphasis on a particular area to really facilitate the work that the scientists want to do. And that's a really nice thing about being at Western.
Yeah, I think so. And I think when I was mentioning resources, I think of a lot of the resources that we're hoping to use, imaging, microscopy, and so forth. Here, they're very easily accessible, and the whole thing is, we think, very well organized, and it just makes it easy to integrate all those different approaches. I think they'll make a difference here, simply because of the type of work we want to do, which is so integrative, right?
Mm-hmm.
For several months, the federal government and much of the country has been gripped by the plight of Syrians escaping desperate circumstances. With the crisis dominating international headlines, the Liberal Party had made a firm commitment to introduce to Canada 25,000 refugees from Syria. However, many observers argue that the situation for refugees in African countries face similarly daunting circumstances and should be extended the same benefits as the Syrians. The following report, put together by CKUW contributor and news director Michael Welch, highlights some of these arguments and the individuals making them.
On Thursday, March 17th, dignitaries, refugees, and community members alike gathered at the Manitoba Interfaith Immigration Council, otherwise known as Welcome Place, to greet an announcement of $500,000 in funding from the federal government's Welcome Fund for Syrian Refugees. These funds are intended to assist the settlement of refugee families in the city of Winnipeg. Advocates for non-Syrian refugees, however, see a serious deficit in the government's approach. Ali Said is a former political prisoner from Ethiopia. He's a longtime refugee advocate and award-winning human rights activist. Said tried to approach John McCallum, the Minister of Immigration, Refugees, and Citizenship, who had been on hand for the announcement to air his concerns.
My fear is, I think the African refugees being forgotten.
Okay, I know.
To me, this is what
we will
I want
try to deal
ask.
With that. Okay.
Outside?
Thank you. Okay. I understand.
Hello. That's not a good answer.
I feel the African refugees are being neglected. The refugees who are suffering in Libya, over 500 refugees are in prison in Libya. If you remember, last year, 30 Ethiopian Christians were slaughtered by ISIS. So the ISIS is abusing and killing and torturing refugees in Libya, but the refugees, especially in Libya, Eritreans, Ethiopians, Sudanese, are not considered as a refugee or what? They have to increase the number of the refugees to come to Canada, especially the African refugees who are suffering a lot in those places.
Gazai Hagos is a refugee from Eritrea and a former journalist. He spoke about the cap that was placed on Canadian visa offices abroad, which limited the number who could come to Canada.
So we have been calling the Canadian government to acknowledge this and give us, you know, at least some sort of resettlement options for at least immediate family members. We understand that he cannot bring everyone, but at least if they can allow us to bring our immediate family members, brothers and sisters or cousins or those who are really in desperate need, and at least allow us lifting part of the caps or subcaps they put in this very important visa posts that are the Nairobi visa post and the Cairo visa post. the UN Human Rights Commission has acknowledged and assigned a special rapporteur to investigate the human rights situation in Eritrea. And after credible reports of that special rapporteur and other sources, they also put up a commission of inquiry to investigate on Eritrean human rights situation. And the commission of inquiry has, after seven months of investigations, where it has heard firsthand from victims of human rights situation in Eritrea, and in June 2015, it produced a report, 484 pages report, that said, yes, there is a widespread and systemic human rights violations in Eritrea, and that may constitute crimes against humanity. There are very few governments that has been subjected to that.
Hasim Ismail is himself a Malaysian seeking refugee status. He is chair of the student refugee program on campus and a member of the No One Is Illegal Winnipeg chapter group. Ismail recognizes the preferential treatment being given to Syrian refugees.
Syrian refugees, the ones that arrived after the Liberals came into power, have their travel loans waived. And the current refugees and the ones that are coming in that are not from Syria will still arrive in Canada with debt or of around $3,000 ish. If it was you, and you're struggling to like pay the rent, and then somebody new arrives and gets a rent paid for because the media is just buzzing about it, and you start thinking, wow, I wish I had media attention. I talked to several Rohingya refugees, and that's the most persecuted group in the world. It's really sad how people have just basically not jumped to help them.
None of the participants in this report begrudge the Liberal government for their generosity towards Syrian refugees. They would simply like to see some acknowledgement from high officials, the media, and society at large of the legitimacy of the appeal for support for refugees of all backgrounds. From Winnipeg on Treaty 1 territory in the heartland of the Métis Nation, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
In that report, you heard from refugee advocate Ali Saeed, Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship Minister John McCallum, Eritrean refugee Gozai Hagose, and Malaysian-born chair of the Student Refugee Program on the University of Winnipeg campus and a member of No One Is Illegal in Winnipeg Treaty 1 territory.
Our next feature is an exploration of the impact of venues on London, Ontario's music scene. Sylvia Posick has the story.
It's springtime, and just over a year ago, I was celebrating my birthday with friends and family and a stellar band at the Blackshire Pub. And today, not a trace of the building is left. The APK has closed, but the Vic Tavern is back. I recently spoke with a few members of London's music community about their experiences and thoughts on the music scene and venues in our city. You'll also hear from Londoners who love live music.
London is so full of creativity, and I like to go out and listen to the live music and hear the original music of the bands because it's great. It's a little piece of their soul.
To support my friends that are playing, and plus, it's therapy, right? Music's therapy. I love it.
Well, hi there. My name is Dana. I play in several bands in London town. The show I play tonight is with Twin Fin. We played at Fitzray's. I play in some other bands. I play in the Alcoholies, also Hill Valley Lightning, and another band called Bang Bang. I actually have a song that I wrote in the Alcoholies called Demolition in Speed City, and it's about all the venues in this town that just continuously close. Demolition, Speed City.
Demolition, Demolition, Speed City. I'm
I grew up going to the embassy. That's where I first started going out to shows and playing with my band in high school called Interstate 69. So that was a great scene for a teenager in this town. But unfortunately, the embassy is now a pile of rubble, as is, you know, the Brunswick Hotel is now a parking lot. And recently, the Blackshire Pub is also a pile of rubble. So it's getting tough to find venues to play in this city. So I'm glad there are places like Fitzroy's, the London Music Hall, which has recently done some renovations, getting some big shows in there. And Twin Fin's actually going to be opening up for David Wilcox. So that's pretty exciting for us.
Yeah, I like to go see live music because it's really important. I like to support artists in the city.
My name is Archie Gamble, and I am the drummer for the band The Buffalo Brothers, based out of London, Ontario. And I'm also a working musician that travels on cruise ships. It's always nice to come back to the music scene in London because it's very thriving, and there's a lot of very talented musicians here. I've been playing professionally full-time for coming up for 30 years, 29 years. I started playing in clubs when I was 15. That was just weekends, sporadic here and there. And at the age of 18, I turned professional playing. You know, there used to be a circuit that existed in Canada where you could play 52 weeks a year if you wanted to, across the country, six, seven nights a week. So I did that for a few years from the age of 18 on. It's become harder to maintain a career as a professional musician. And, you know, it's gone up and down over the years in terms of how many venues there are. I've seen a lot of changes in the last 25 years I've lived here. A lot of the opportunities have dried up, but it's still there. You just have to apply yourself, and you have to sacrifice. You know, it's, any musician will tell you it's not an easy way to make a living. But at the end of the day, you're doing what you love. And so that's the yin to the yang, you know.
Part of the City of London's music strategy, they've recently hired a music industry development officer, Corey Crossman. Corey took some time to share his thoughts with me. He says it's great to see the new venues popping up, like the Vic, 765 Old East, and new music nights at Fitzroy's. It's important for venues to offer opportunities for live music to take place, especially original artists. After all, original artists are what make cities like Seattle, Nashville, and Chicago great music cities.
Now it's time for our community radio report. Last February, Western University's Student Council held a motion to add a referendum to seize funding to the campus radio station on the basis that only a small portion of students actually benefit from the station, while every student contributes funding to CHRW from their tuition.
Everyone's student experience at Western is different. So as much as we have all of these different opportunities on campus, the USC needs to understand that, of course, not everyone's going to take advantage of the different opportunities. I mean, having campus radio has contributed to my Western experience, and I think that is incredible. And now that I'm going to graduate, it's definitely going to be something that I can look back on and hopefully use as kind of a jumpstart into a career. Being a volunteer at CHRW has opened so many different doors for me as someone who wants to be in the journalism industry after I finish my degree. I've been able to host a radio show. I've been able to attend events and write stories on them and interview people. And it's just all these different things that are contributing to my experience at CHRW that I wouldn't have been able to do anywhere else.
CHRW volunteers, students, and community members came together to organize a campaign highlighting the importance of community and campus radio.
And we had lots of really great input from our volunteers, both community and our student volunteers, and it was really awesome to see everyone really come together and build something for the station and for the presentation. We had about 8 volunteers that ended up presenting the day of. And the flurry of activity that happened before the presentation was, it felt really good to see that support. We also had, I think, about 60 community members and volunteers that came out to see the presentation that we did with the USC. And to see that room really fill up was you're really feeling the love and the support.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by the volunteers at CHRW in London, Ontario. Music this week was by Whoopso, and headlines this week were written by Ome Selma Rahamtula and Sarah May Chitty. We also thank Gretchen King, Sarah May Chitty, and Istiana Bastari. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncr.ca or podcast at rabble.ca/podcasts.